What touched me was that I felt I was wanted here. And I should have never said that. And she was very proud of me. She gave me a job washing dishes. Or it's the boss. They don't care how hard I work. Even in the courts, it's fun to walk with in this world of ours. St. Francis said, for it is in self-forgetting that you find you wish to love. That is, you're right. When somebody called me up one night and he said, you know, Pat died, all I could think of was what he told me, you have to be perfect to be able to love. If you go back and ask Rita, she gave me $100. So her station wagon, who the hell wants her anyway? Didn't get the message, huh? So I took her. But why? Nobody honored his opinion either. Nobody respected him. He was alone and lonely.
I go to a lot of AA meetings with my partner, and so I get to hear this a lot. And for years, you know, this part, and much to my complete surprise, I feel that I am a loving and compassionate person towards myself, and it was. And out of the silence comes my partner's voice, and she says, rude and selfish. So, but on the other hand, you know, I spoke it. But what am I holding on to? You know, I'm the notion that, and I really want to let go of it. August, my partner's dad fell and broke his hip, had to have hip replaced. And that's because, you know, my favorite flow of and hold on to absolutely is my awareness of who I am, of me that is real, not somebody else's fantasy of me, that I really exist, that I'm good, that I have a truth to share, that I can love and be compassionate. I can be compassionate towards my mom. And I'm still working on letting go of those lingering, ever more subtle resentments. My partner. My dog. And all those around me, including me, who are temporarily caught in a conflict, whether it's a little conflict around who turns the bedroom light on, or it's a big, huge conflict far away, I can be loving and compassionate with all those caught temporarily in a conflict on the small domestic scene, on the larger world stage. And for this, I have to express Al-Anon and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which, of course, got me to Al-Anon. And my gratitude to you all, because you are the program that the program gives us, and to our higher power. So thank you for listening to me, and may the love and peace of the program grow in us one day at a time. Thank you.
Thank you, Judy.
Hi, my name's June. I'd be invited down here on the night that Cliff's celebrating his birthday. I had a really special day. I was really grateful that Carrie was able to have an FBI raid and have her office closed down a few weeks ago so she could drive down here with me today because she's not working. I think I was more grateful than she was about that. But and then I got to spend some time with Linda, and Linda and I had, we used to be neighbors in Culver City, and so it was really fun to get to catch up on a few things with her. And then I had the privilege of having dinner with Cliff and Pat and with their family. And, you know, I Cliff mentioned, you know, that that this is his tribe and that he has a family, and he does. He has a wonderful family. I think, though, you know, for me, I had a family, technically, when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But my family wanted nothing to do with me. And you know, it sounded to me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous as though everyone else took a 30, or perhaps, if they were really bad, a 90-day chip, and then their family reunited and lived happily ever after, you know. And I was, I believe, 5 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and very, very active before I was invited to attend a holiday function with my family. So for me, the wreckage of my past was very, very slow, you know, in changing. And so when I was about 3 years sober and I met Cliff, and I get to go spend time with their family, it was kind of like mine, you know, and it was funny because I was a little bit older than a couple of their kids, and so when, you know, when Cliff would say, "Who did that?" they'd say, "June did it." And so I really felt like I was a part of the family. You know? I'd been an only child, and no one had ever really blamed me for something in the family. Or if they had, I had done it. You know, there really wasn't anybody else to say they did it. They didn't even ask who did it. You know, who stole that? It was June, you know. So anyway, so it's really special for me. And, you know, the process of Alcoholics Anonymous, I think if there is a fault with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I have seen, it's that this program works so darn slowly. And we lose a lot of members because of that. You know, we really do. I mean, we're into quick answers, you know. I always was. And I watch people in Alcoholics Anonymous so many times, you know, giving up before things change and get better. And then they get different, then they get bad, and then they get different, and then they get better, you know. And it's just sort of, I guess, the process of life. But there's a lot of times, you know, where I don't want to... I guess, you know, I don't have that much humility, you know what I mean, about, you know, showing up and doing it again. I was reading, you know, some of the literature, and it was saying, you know, that this is an ongoing process, and we need to have a new spiritual start, and it's as if our garden has to be constantly weeded out, you know, to keep things, and it's like, you know, I don't like weeding. I mean, I really don't, you know, and I mean, I just want a garden, you know. I've done all that stuff, and I want a garden, you know. And I really get very frustrated sometimes that I still have to do the weeding, you know. And I have to remember that that's not, you know, that's not a lot of humility to think that I'm somebody that doesn't have to do the weeding, you know, like everybody else. You know, I am a person today that I wouldn't have even liked when I came to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I live a life today that I would have wanted nothing to do with, and yet I'm happier today most of the time than I've ever been in my life, and I was never a happy person. And I think it's really important, you know, as it talks about in the book, that we that when we're asked to share, that we talk a little bit about what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like today, because I think that that gives a perspective on what Alcoholics Anonymous has accomplished in my life. And that what it accomplishes really in all our lives. You know, I spoke a number of years ago at a meeting back in my hometown, and this guy came up to me after the meeting and thanked me for speaking, mainly because his sponsor made him. And the sponsor was standing right behind him, kind of pushing him, you know. And he shook my hand, and he said, "You know, I want to thank you for your talk." He said, "I really liked that story." He said, "I don't believe it was your story, but I like the way that you told it." And, you know, and I thought, you know, it's only in Alcoholics Anonymous that you could be so paranoid and, you know, that you would think people would, like, make up stories, come here for years and years and go to meetings till they could get asked to speak to say the stories, you know. But had accomplished in my life. Because in July of 1972, when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I looked exactly like my story. I looked like I had been where I had been. And nobody particularly wanted to go there, you know, least of all me, you know. I'm one of those people that believes I was born an alcoholic, and I don't want to have a philosophical discussion with anybody about that. It's just what I believe. There was something way wrong with me long before I ever started to drink. My first obsession in life was suicide, and I began to try and kill myself from the time that I was 4 and 5 years old. That's as far back as I remember, and those were my earliest memories, were plotting different ways to die. And I would cut my hands and my fingers and my wrists with razor blades, and I would beat my face and my body with hammers, and I would burn myself with lighters and matches and different things. And I did a lot of things to hurt myself. And as I look back on it, I know what that was. I mean, it was like I always knew. I just hated everything about me. You know, and I sort of felt like if I could just hammer my nose different, you know, if I could just change, if I couldn't die, if I could at least just change. And you know what it really was, as I thought about it more, in my opinion, and I certainly have no background in this whatsoever. I mean, it's all, you know, my opinion. But in my opinion, as I look back on it, I was one of those people that I could always tolerate physical pain 10,000 times more than emotional pain. And so I always tried to make sure that that's what I went for. And in my life, I was to find that in human relationships, I preferred to get punched in the face than to have somebody hurt my feelings. And so I tried to make it a point to get my face punched in a lot, and I was quite successful at it. I can say that I achieved that goal on a regular basis. I hated everything about myself. I didn't want to be where I was. I didn't want to be who I was. I didn't want to be doing what I was doing. And most of all, I didn't want to feel the way that I felt. And so for someone like me, the fact that I found drugs when I was 7 years old and then I began to drink on a regular basis when I was 8, and that I found a combination by the time I was 9 that I never altered, which was barbiturates or downers or reds or yellows or, you know, sleeping pills, whatever you might call them, and alcohol combined, that worked for me. I wasn't a party girl. I've never had a social drink in my life. I've never wanted one. I've never not been drunk when I drank. It was just the way that that it worked for me. And I truly believe if I hadn't found those chemicals and alcohol, I would have had to have been locked up in some kind of an institution, because I really could not make it out there. And I know a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous are not going to identify. They didn't start at that point. But this is, you know, I mean, when I was growing up, I was raised in an alcoholic family. I knew a lot about alcoholism firsthand. There was a lot of violence in my home. There was a lot of broken promises in my home. There was a lot of the same kind of stuff going on in my alcoholic home that go on in a lot of other alcoholic homes. And I knew that I was never going to be that way. I didn't see alcoholism as a disease. I saw it as a weakness. And in my life, there's never been anything that I've hated more in anyone, most of all myself, than those things that I was to decide were weaknesses. And I felt that, you know, that my mom and her alcoholism was a weakness, and I was never going to be weak, not like that. I went ahead and I looked around at people, and the way that I saw the world before coming to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't ever remember seeing a man cry under any circumstances. I've seen men shot. I've seen them stabbed. I've seen them beaten up. I've seen them arrested. I've seen their wives leave them. I've seen their kids overdose. I've seen them go through a lot of different life experiences. I never saw a man cry under any of those circumstances. And to me, that meant that men don't feel anything. The only emotion I ever remember seeing men have was anger and rage. And I thought that's all they ever felt. And I watched the women in my life going through all those same experiences, and some of them didn't cry, but most of them did at one point or another. There seemed to be a breaking point. And I looked at those two different groups of people, and I decided immediately which one I wanted to be like. And I spent my whole life trying to be what I thought a man was. And to me, a man was someone who cared about no one, who felt absolutely nothing, and if they did, they never let anyone know it. And the only emotion that they seemed to experience was anger and rage. And that was okay with me. That seemed to be a good way to go. The only problem was that I was one of those people that, you know, that I've heard Clancy put so perfectly for me. I was a person who was born without any insulation for my emotions at all, so that absolute strangers could give me a look and it would hurt my feelings, you know. And and when the kids, when I first went to school and the kids would tease me about being tall or being skinny or having curly red hair, I felt like I was being cut up inside with knives, and I would want to start to cry, and sometimes I would. And so I found out about myself from my earliest memory that I was the thing that I hated the most in the entire world, that I was weak, that absolute strangers could hurt my feelings, let alone people that I cared about, you know, and I never forgave myself for it. And thank God for the alcohol, you know, because that was what took the pain away. It just made me not care, and that's what I needed. I was a little kid, and they said, what do you want to be when you grow up? I said, a boy. Wasn't as easy to do back then as it is today. And my family is and was very active in the Catholic Church. They were very concerned that I had this, you know, it wasn't like I said this once. I mean, I meant it, and they knew that. So they began to take me to priests to talk to me and to convince me that this was not a good idea. And that was not very effective, and we were on welfare. And so my mom, I guess maybe through a priest, I don't know, but found out that I could see psychologists and eventually psychiatrists for this desire that I had to be a boy. And, you know, I really can't give you any kind of diagnosis about why they thought that I, you know, tried to kill myself, or why I hated myself, or why I wanted to be a boy, because I felt about psychologists and psychiatrists the way that my friend Patty Hicks always did. I thought they should have to work for their money. And so I never told them anything. I never answered one question. I didn't fill out one form. I wouldn't play with one doll. I wasn't playing, you know. But that was just the way that I was, you know. And finally, I accepted within myself that I wasn't going to be able to be a boy. And so the way that I saw the world, the only option for someone like me was to be a tough broad. And I grew up in a town called Venice, and it's a beach town. And I've learned in sobriety by meeting other tough broads from different geographical areas that some things about being a tough broad are geographic, you know. And so being that Venice is a beach town, if you're going to be a tough broad in Venice, it's very important that you have tough and I could walk on glass with my feet. I was very proud. I would look for glass and walk on it when people were watching. And one of my favorite things was when touristy-looking people were watching me to take my cigarette butts and to throw them down on the boardwalk and to put them out with my bare feet. And then I would see these touristy-looking people, and they would whisper back and forth, and I knew what they were saying. They were saying, wow, that is one tough broad. And I was very impressed that I could do this, and I knew they had to be even more impressed than I was, you know. And after I'd been sober for a while, my sponsor explained to me that perhaps what some of those people were saying to one another was, did you see that? That person just put flesh to fire. Why would anybody do anything so stupid, you know? But I didn't even know there was another way of looking at it. I just thought it was a very tough thing to do. And then just being able to step on lit cigarette butts did not mean you were truly tough. You were only truly tough if you were then able to walk upon those feet as if it did not hurt. And those were the kind of things that kept me busy before I came down to college. You know, it's not a very exciting story. It's just the way that it was. I was in a gang because I tough broads should be in one. And if you're going to be in a gang, you should do a lot of fighting, and I did. I've never won a fight in my life, but I've never fought less than 5 people at a time. And my sponsor, again, explained to me that the reason I always fought groups of 5 or more is if you fight one person, they might think you're not a very good fighter. If you fight groups of 5 or more, no one expects you to win. And they think, why would that many people have to jump you unless you were really tough? So that was kind of the way that I sort of set things up, you know. I was brought to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous by my mother, and my mother had been in and out of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for many, many years with varying lengths of sobriety. Today my mom has not had a drink in over 15 years, maybe 18 actually, but she doesn't attend meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, so I don't really know whether she considers herself a member of Alcoholics Anonymous or not. But she is sober, and sometimes, you know, I get so caught up in my own story, I leave her out there drinking, so just so that you know that that happens. Anyway, but she was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for many, many years with varying lengths of sobriety. She brought me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, not because I asked for help, not because I wanted help, not because Well, I thought I had a problem, but just because she thought if she left me alone, I might get her evicted from another apartment. And I sat in the meeting that night, and the miracle of this program began for me that night because there was a man in that meeting that I admired more than anybody else in the whole world. And I admired him for a lot of reasons, some of which you may not identify with, but they were what kept me coming back. I admired Paul because he was from my neighborhood in Venice, because he rode a motorcycle, because he had tattoos, because he'd been to jails and prisons, because he had a knife and had it with him at the meeting that night. And because he was, and I just thought, wow, I never thought people this tough came to AA. I thought it was just for weak people like my mom. And I was very impressed. You know, if I had to tell you what I wanted out of life in one sentence when I came to AA, I wanted the ability to walk into a room full of strangers and have everyone there back away from me in terror. Now, when you're 87 pounds, that almost never happens. You know, but that's what I wanted out of life. And Paul is the kind of guy, he was actually a drinking friend of my mother's, and I had seen him walk into bars or into parties, and if he'd been drinking and he wanted to sit at your table, you just gave him the whole table. You didn't talk about it. You just gave it to him because you didn't know what he was going to do next. And so here was a man who had achieved everything that I wanted out of life, the ability to clear rooms and tables, and he was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it impressed me. I got drunk the next night, and then I came back to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in between the meetings, I talked to Paul. He was the only person cool enough here, as far as I was concerned, for me to talk to. And I explained to Paul that I wasn't an alcoholic, that I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic, that I was far too young to be an alcoholic, that I had places to go, people to see, things to do, I had my whole life ahead of me, that I was nothing like my mother, who was very, very alcoholic, and that I was just quite obviously not alcoholic. And I later learned that non-alcoholics don't have to spend any time trying to convince other people that they're not alcoholic. You know, they already know that. But Paul turned to me and he said, you know, June, I'm pretty new in this AA thing right now, and they've told me that I can't diagnose anybody's disease but my own. He said, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception. I see the way that you drink and the way that you use chemicals, and I happen to believe within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be out on the streets, you're going to be shooting stuff, and you're going to be selling your ass. And I knew he wasn't trying to scare me. He wasn't trying to make up something like a teacher in high school might do about something they didn't know anything about. He was just talking about facts. He was talking about things that had begun to happen in my life and were happening, and he was talking about things that had happened in his life. And I knew that that's what he was saying. But I did not want to join Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I didn't want to join any organization that was allowing my mother to belong to it. I mean, it was just not, you know, what I wanted at all. I really thought that Alcoholics Anonymous was the bottom, and I just didn't think it was that bad yet. And it wasn't then. But in that two-week period, absolutely every alternative but Alcoholics Anonymous was removed from my life. I had been living with my mother at that time for a very short period of time. By the time I came to the program of alcohol, everything that had ever gone wrong in my life, and being that she was an alcoholic and I had some pretty good stories, it had worked in a lot of different situations over the years, you know, and it wasn't until after I got sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I learned that if I didn't start taking some responsibility for my own life, nothing was ever going to change. But at that time, it was just a lot easier to blame her. And I hated her, and I hated me. And because of the kind of person that I was, I used to attack my mother physically. And she was sober at that time, even though she drank after that, but she was sober at that time, and she didn't think she had to be subjected to being attacked in her own apartment, and she asked me to leave, and I did. The rest of my family had not talked to me in a couple of years. I was not allowed to call or come by under any circumstances, and I didn't bother trying. I'd been in a lot of foster homes. I'd been thrown out of all of them. None of them would take me back. I tried to get into some drug rehab and alcohol recovery homes. There were only a few back then, but the ones that were available in L.A., and none of them would take me, some because of my age and some just because of my attitude. And then I thought, well, you know what? Who cares? Who cares about all these families and these programs and these groups and, you know, all that? None of that really.
My prayer is, God, if you ain't here, we're screwed.
Matters. If you're a tough broad, the only thing that really matters is your own gang. And then one day as I walked down an alley, all five members of my own gang beat me up. And I found myself sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was 87 pounds, and I had a black eye, and I had a swollen lip, and I had no shoes. I wouldn't have worn shoes if I'd had them at that time, but I didn't have any. I had the clothes that I was wearing, and I had no family. I had no place to live, and I raised my hand in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can see where it was really pretty simple. It wasn't like, would you like to go to Hawaii or join AA? You know, I mean, it was just, that was it. And when I first began to raise my hand, because my mom had been in Alcoholics Anonymous, and knew a lot of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous at the meetings that I was going to. They knew how old I was. And they came over to me and they told me that that I was too young to be an alcoholic. And they didn't want a little kid sitting in their meetings while they talked about serious things. And they told me that if I came back, they'd get together and throw me out. And I did not know that Alcoholics Anonymous had a third tradition, the one that says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking, which means that no one anywhere can ever throw anyone out of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe that those people at that time did not know that Alcoholics Anonymous had that tradition either. But I most certainly did not know. I just figured AA didn't want me either, and that was okay with me, because I didn't want me either. And I had it for a long, long time. And I fell back on my number one answer, the answer that I'd been using since I was 5 years old. I went over to a friend of my mother's. I went into her bathroom, which is the first place I went at anyone's house I ever visited, and I found enough pills to kill myself, and I took enough of them to do it. And then that day before I passed out, I went to a noon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And by the time I got to the meeting, I could not stand and I could not sit. I laid in the meeting. I don't know about where you guys go to meetings out here, but in West L.A. in 1970, but for some reason they called on me that day, and they realized that I needed to be in a hospital, and that's where I next remember waking up. And then I remember a doctor explaining to me that the pills I had taken were to slow down my heart, and had I been there 5 or 10 minutes later, I would have been in a coma that they probably couldn't have brought me out of. And I really can't tell you why that overdose was any different than all the others that I'd inflicted upon myself over the time that I was out there. I just know that it was different, because since that time, I haven't taken anything that affects me from the neck up. That's how I personally define sobriety. Done that one day at a time. The 13th of July is my birthday. If I continue to do what I'm doing one day at a time, I'll celebrate 24 continuous years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, for those of you who are new, I never planned on staying sober 23 and a half years. You know, I mean, if they'd asked me if I wanted to go on living or not 23 and a half years, I would have checked the no box. You know, I mean, I just really didn't, I just wasn't interested. And, you know, I wasn't one of the people that stayed in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because if I went back out there, I might start drinking and I might die. I've never thought I'd be that lucky, because I tried to die as long and as hard as I could out there. I've always believed I'm one of those people that could go back out there and live for another 20 or 30 or 40 years like some of the other people in Alcoholics Anonymous were able to do before they got here. And I'll tell you, by the time I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I could not go on breathing in and out two more times, hitting myself any more than I did. So there wasn't any way that I could have gone on with where I was for another 20 or 30 years. It just wasn't possible given the way that I felt about myself. When I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 13 years old, and people were guessing my age at 37 when they didn't know how old I was. And I'll tell you, I look a hell of a lot better today, and I'm almost 37, than I did at that 37, you know what I mean, when I was 13. And the biggest difference is not even how I look, it's how I feel. I cannot even describe to you how old I was when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I was very, very old. I was very, very tired. I didn't want to go anywhere. I didn't want to do anything. I didn't have any dreams. I didn't want to go on any trips. I didn't want to read any books. You know, I didn't want to get a career. I just wanted to die. That was it. And I couldn't even seem to do that. And I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I listened to the people, and they shared about the way that they had felt about themselves by the time they came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and how much self-hatred they had, or lack of self-esteem, or whatever you want to call it. And yet it seemed to me, and I think it was true, that for most of the people that I was hearing, that they reached a point where they liked themselves, or where they could look themselves in the mirror, or where they were their own best friend, or where they, you know, they described it in a lot of different ways. And I listened to those people share about that, and I did not believe that that could happen for me. Absolutely not possible. But the stories in Alcoholics Anonymous that people shared here were so filled with hope that even as hateful and cynical as I was about everyone and everything, I did get a glimmer of hope. And I began to believe that if I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I tried really, really hard, maybe someday when I was walking down a street and I happened to glance in one of those store windows and see myself, because that was the only way I was going to see myself, because I wasn't standing in front of any mirrors or putting on any makeup or any of that. But I might look in one of those store mirrors, and when I saw who I was looking back, maybe I wouldn't feel like throwing up. And that was enough hope to keep me coming back, that someday I could get to a point where I might catch a glance of myself and I wouldn't feel like throwing up at where I'd come from and what I'd been and what I'd done. And so I kept coming back for that. I got very active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous from the very beginning. I went to 21 meetings a week most of my first couple of years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm very, very grateful to the people who were here when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm very grateful to my home group back then, which was the Monday Night Venice group. And it was an unusual group, you know. You really can't describe it. You just had to be there. It's like one of those jokes, you know. But it was the perfect group for me. And I felt comfortable there, and I got a commitment there. And I never missed that meeting. You know, somebody told me, and they were probably kidding, you know, that you go to a meeting every day in your first year unless you're in the hospital. You know, and I was at least one every single day. I remember when I was a couple of months sober, I got these big lumps behind my ears, and they really hurt. And it would never have occurred to me to go to a doctor. I went to a meeting, and I had a couple of the old-timers feel these lumps. And they told me it was swollen glands. And they got bigger and bigger, and they hurt more and more. And I was on my regular 21 meetings a week pace. And after a couple of days or so, I was so swelled up that one of my friends made me go to a doctor. And he drove me over, and he took me to a doctor. And I went in, and I saw the doctor. And the doctor said, "You have the mumps." And I said, "No, I don't. I have swollen glands. I'm not going to believe a doctor over an old-timer. I mean... You know, I mean, there just wasn't an issue there. They had nothing to say, you know. But he convinced me that I did have the mumps. And he said, "You know, this is very contagious." He said, "Have you been around anybody, you know?" And so I went home and I called this one guy from my home group. He was the first person I called. And I said, "Hi, Keith." I said, "I got to call you because I was at the doctor today and he told me I had the mumps, and he said it's kind of dangerous for guys and I should call and tell people." And he said, "That's okay, kid. You can't keep it unless you give it away." And I didn't miss one meeting. I mean, I didn't modify my schedule at all. I was just out there, you know. I had a really bad attitude when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't like I got sober and got a bad attitude. I just came here with the only attitude I had ever had, and I had a bad attitude. I did not like women. I didn't like me. I didn't like my mother. I figured any other women around here had to be like one of the two of us, and I didn't like them. I didn't want to sit next to women. I did not want to shake hands with women. I most certainly was not going to hug women, and I did not like listening to women speakers, which is something that always makes me feel better because I know there are never as many people listening to me as it looks like. Now, the only men I'd ever known in my life were alcoholics who were extremely violent. I figured all the men around here were alcoholics. They were probably violent, and they scared me. I didn't want anything to do with any of them. You know? And I would go to these meetings. I didn't wear shoes most of the first 2 years that I was sober. I didn't take them off to go to the meeting. I mean, I just didn't wear them anywhere. And I certainly wasn't going to put them on for a meeting. You know, I just didn't wear shoes. I wore motorcycle chains on my wrists and my ankles. I wore a motorcycle jacket that on the back said, "Do unto others and then split." And it was my own little spiritual slogan. I had a very limited vocabulary when I came to AA. Consisted almost solely of profanity. There were a few exceptions, the and mother. And there were a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous who were extremely offended by the use of that type of language. And so I tried to use it more when they were around. I wore T-shirts with things on them that all people, I think, I could say this safely, including myself today, would find extremely offensive. I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day, and I lit them all myself. I took up, after a short time in AA, I took up smoking cigars and then later a pipe. And if you choose to dress the way that I did and smoke the way that I did and talk the way that I did, you too can sit in a meeting just about this size and have an entire... The only requirement for AA membership was a desire to stop drinking. And I just got really active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was all I had to hang on to. The only place that I felt the least bit safe was in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was over 10 years sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous before I could put a dollar in a basket. You know, I felt like a huge failure in Alcoholics Anonymous a lot of the time. And yet, as I look back on it, being the kind of person that I am and was, I'm ever so grateful that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous so broke that I couldn't afford to pay attention, because it made me do service work. Because since I couldn't put a dollar in the basket or $2 in the basket and feel like I'd paid my debt here, I had to make sure that every meeting I ever attended got more than that in work. Because I didn't want anybody saying I was not paying my own way. I didn't want anybody thinking I needed any help. And so I always did, you know, more chairs than were a dollar or $2 worth of work. You know, more ashtrays, more, you know, whatever it was, to give me a right to stay in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I thought I needed that. You know, I didn't know that I'd be allowed to stay here. Anyway, and because of the people that were in my home group, it was a very, very active group. And so we traveled a lot, and we went to a lot of places, and we had a committee of where we would meet, and we would make tapes for the loners. And so I learned about the loners in Alcoholics Anonymous that lived in different places and didn't have the opportunity to go to meetings. And we would send them tapes, and we would get back tapes. And I started to learn about general service and started to learn about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I learned about the central office. And, you know, back then we used to have a lot of 12-step calls, and I had the privilege to be able to go on those 12-step calls. And to have a constant reminder, you know, of where I ought to be. And then, you know, if you hang around in Alcoholics Anonymous long enough, then you actually see some of the people, you know, who go back out and who die. And you start to realize that, you know, that this is really a gift. I think, you know, it talks about, you know, in the book, your whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. And I can't tell you exactly how or when that happened. I just know that it has. You know, before I got sober, or even in my early sobriety, I was so self-centered that if I saw two people talking, I was insulted, you know, and I could get a resentment. And if I saw them look at me, I knew what they were saying, and I could hate them for it, you know, because I just really believed that all conversations, in AA or out, basically revolved around me and who I was and where I came from. And today, I actually sometimes get insulted and I miss it because I'm just not looking for it. You know, I think, was that person rude to me? I think they were, you know. And I missed it. And I mean, before, man, I was like, you know, I was 30 minutes ahead of you being rude to me with my attitude. You know, there just wasn't, you didn't even get a chance to be fully rude before I got right in there. He's like, are you thinking about being rude? You know. And I can remember I saw this bumper sticker. I don't even know how long I was sober, but it said, you're ugly and your mother dresses you funny. And I can remember laughing. I was a number of years sober because I didn't laugh until I was a number of years sober because there was nothing funny. But I remember laughing, and I remember thinking, you know, if I'd seen this in the early months or years of my sobriety, I would have, like, stopped. And I was like, hey, what's wrong with the way I dress? And you don't know my mother, okay? So, you know, I mean, it's just like a different thing. Getting a sense of humor is one of the greatest gifts that I've ever been given in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've gotten it here from the people who came before me, you know, and some of the ones that have come after me that have let me practice my jokes on them. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a seventh grade education. I had dropped out of school, and I did not go back. I was unwilling and unable to go back, I believe. And instead, I got the kind of jobs that you can get with a seventh grade education. And I did those jobs for a while, and I began to think, you know, if I, at this rate, if I do this job, which I hate now, for the next 45 years of my life, one day at a time, this is going to be a really long time, you know. And that eventually motivated me to listen to my sponsors and to try and, you know, and get a GED, you know, and to see if I could go out there and do something else. And it was just, you know, such a fascinating, you know, kind of a journey along the way. And, you know, the way that things, like, kind of turned out. You know, in my home group, you know, at the Monday Night Adventist group, they would say it's really important that you get the big book, you know, just like they were saying tonight. And said, we make liberal credit arrangements, just like they said tonight. But then at the Monday Night Adventist group, they'd say, but if you don't want to talk to somebody or you're too afraid to talk to somebody, you just go ahead and steal it. Now, I'd been stealing longer than I'd been drinking. And I didn't see any reason to give up stealing because I was giving up drinking. They were unrelated activities as far as I was concerned, but I was kind of superstitious, and I thought maybe if I stole the big book from an AA meeting, it might jinx my sobriety. And so instead, I went to the library in Santa Monica, and I stole the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And while I was there, I stole a copy of the 12 and 12. And I didn't feel bad about that. I'd heard a lot of people talk about that book, too, so I thought it must be kind of important. And I can remember, you know, talking to one of my first sponsors then. And I called him up that day, and I said, hi, Jeff. I said, I stole the big book today. And I can remember, you know, it's just so many, Jeff did not say to me, you know, June, we no longer steal. You know, we try and live a life of rigorous honesty here. We do things different. I remember he said, that's great, you got the book, you know, because for someone like me, if it was important enough to steal, I mean, I was getting involved. And I can remember, you know, my home group today is the Thursday Night Brentwood group, which has a format a little bit similar to this meeting tonight. And when I was 18 years sober, the steering committee there asked me to be the secretary. And my first sponsor, Jeff, the same guy, he drove out from the valley about 45 minutes, and he came up to me after the meeting when I was signing court cards, and he said, I heard a rumor in the valley that they made you secretary here, and I had to come and see if it was true. You know, it's like, that's where I came from. I had to attend that group for 18 years before they decided that they might let me have a commitment. You know, I mean, she's wearing shoes most of the time now. You know, she seems to be different. Maybe we could give her a try. And that's what I mean. It's really slow here, you know. I went ahead and I did go back to school and kind of took, you know, a class here or there and got an opportunity to keep going. And I went ahead and took more and more classes and got a job on campus. And after a while, I finished these classes and they called it at this college, they called it an AA degree, which I thought was a nice name for a college degree. I never wanted a college degree, but I kind of liked that. And when I finished that, I went ahead and I continued and I went on to school after that. And I got I graduated from a university. And during this time, I'd been doing the footwork that my sponsors had taught me that I had to do. They told me it was the same footwork anybody in or out of AA had to do. I just had to do it, you know. And I did that footwork, and I got a telegram 15 years ago now telling me that I'd been chosen as one of 300 applicants out of 300 out of 3,000 applicants to go to law school. And I'll tell you, when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I always planned on spending a lot of time in court. But never on that side of the table, you know. And it was just really amazing to me that Alcoholics Anonymous could have accomplished that with what I brought. I think I want to talk about, you know, one other interesting thing that happened. You know, I talked about this guy Paul and how you know, he kept me coming back, but Paul didn't stay. And Paul was like my mom. He was in and out of the program for a very long time. And somewhere about maybe 5 years ago, maybe six, I'm not really sure, I was in downtown Culver City, and I was walking down the street, and I had not seen Paul since 1972 when I got sober. And I saw this guy, and he didn't look so tough anymore. He looked like a little old guy. And he was walking down the street in Culver City, and I knew that guy. And I stopped, and I said, Paul? And he looked at me, and he didn't know who I was for a while. And we talked, and Paul was on his way to the pet store there with his little bird, Petey. And he said he was taking his little bird, Petey, into the pet store because he needed to have his little wings clipped because the day before, Petey had gotten out of his room, out of the hotel. And he said Petey was the only friend he had, that his mom wouldn't talk to him and his brother wouldn't talk to him, and his daughter sent back the letters, not interested, you know, moved. And we went and, you know, I said, let me buy you a cup of coffee. It was like 9 o'clock in the morning. And we went into this little coffee shop, and he ordered a beer. And he's the only person I've ever bought a beer for. that I knew was an alcoholic or that had admitted at one time that they were, but I just couldn't believe seeing him, and I had a cup of coffee. Then we talked, and I told him that that I was married, and that I was a lawyer, and that I'd been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, maybe 18 years at that time. And he just, I can't believe it, and he started to cry. And he said, I must have really taught you well. And I said, you did. You know, and we didn't have a very long conversation. And he left. And about a couple of years ago, I heard that Paul was sober. But, you know, I had known Paul to go to meetings for over 30 years. And he'd been sober a few times in that time. And I heard that he was sober, like I said, a couple of years ago. But about a month ago, I went into this little coffee shop on my way to a meeting. And I was standing behind this guy in line who had a sticker stuck on his jacket that said, Fragile, Handle with Care. And I kind of just recognized that guy, and he turned around, and it was Paul. And he had 3 years sober. And he told me that after I'd seen him, he'd had a stroke. And that he'd ended up in a coma, and he'd been hospitalized for a really long time. And that he had, in November of this year, he celebrated 3 years of sobriety. And, you know, as we talked, I had never known that Paul attended his first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous when he was 15 years old in an institution. And this year in March, Paul's going to be 60. You know, and it took Paul... It's that 42 years. I'm not good at math, you know, but it took him a hell of a long time, you know, and I'm so grateful that this guy was able to give me the gift, even though it took him that long to get it himself. I want to read this one part of the book, and then I'll just open it up for questions. We have shown you how we got out from under. You say, yes, I'm willing, but am I to be consigned to a life where I shall be stupid, boring, and glum, like some righteous people I see? I know I must get along without liquor, but how can I? Have you a sufficient substitute? Yes, there is a substitute, and it is vastly more than that. It is a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we find the fellowship, and so will you. And you know, the part in there that probably is the most meaningful for me is where it says, life will mean something at last. Because that didn't seem like a possibility to me when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and yet you've made that come true. I have a life today that most of the time I don't want to trade with anybody. Thanks for inviting me.
My name is Mark Houston. I'm an alcoholic. And God blessed me with sobriety on October the 19th in 1982.
I'd like to thank the committee for taking a chance and inviting my wife and I here to share. And when I say take a chance, they didn't know what I was going to say, neither do I. But I would like to think this is a great honor to be one of the speakers that starts off this inaugural meeting. I was sitting here thinking a minute ago, and I don't get too serious because I don't like that. And this is called the Northwest Pockets of Enthusiasm. And my addition to it, it's born on the spirit within. That's where it comes from. I believe that. Because I'm enthusiastic about this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm absolutely enthusiastic. You know, the most amazing thing I have found out in this program, and if you want to know, I've heard them, I don't want to be too different. They've all got up here so nicely and told you when their sobriety dates were, to let you know, my sobriety date is September 6, 1967. And I'm most grateful for that. And I know it's only by the grace of God. And slowly, but total, complete surrender, that I stand here today. I'm a dummy. See, because I have a genius type mind. I have the kind of mind, and some of you may not have it, but I have the kind of mind that makes puking make sense. If you think about it, it's got to make sense, because you find the rationale to keep doing it. So that's a great mind to do that. Made going to jail make sense? So that's, you know, Paul said, I'm kind of kicked back. What I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is not to listen to me. Real simple stuff. Don't listen to you. If you knew when I tell guys and those that you don't know what to do, I'll tell you the first thing, quit listening to yourself. And it makes sense. See, because I don't like to dig. I'm not that kind of digger. I got here in 1967, totally beat. Alcohol beat me to death. Alcohol. Nothing else. I didn't come here because of the tiddlywinks. I came here because alcohol beat me to death. I remember distinctly the thought that ran through my head. If I stay on this stage 1 second longer, I will die. I remember it clearly because, you know, I had a 25 in my shirt. I had a 45 under the seat of my car and nobody was after me. But I also knew if I stayed on that stage 1 second longer, I would die. I knew that without question. And I had to come back to Southern California to Ruby, you'll hear her, and tell her she was married to an alcoholic. And at that time, Ruby thought, I've been up here in this town singing and carrying on. Somebody reminded me the night of today of the hotel. I was trying to think of it as the Rid Path. You know, I play in, and there was one up here called the Davenport. You know, I play in all those cool upholstered sewers, you know. I play those things. But you see, Ruby never knew she had married an alcoholic because when you're cool like I am, and you can lie good like I can, you know, what's the point in telling her? And she knew, I didn't want to tell her what I was like. She didn't have a clue. You see, because I'm cool. God, I can lie. If I didn't lie, I had such wonderful inferences going. I'm such a master of half truth. You know, I see you shaking hands. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? Yeah, go ahead. You know, because if you lie, you got to remember it. If you tell a half-truth, somebody else will supply it. You know, that's the kind of guy he was, you know. So I couldn't tell if he was married to an alcoholic. And the day came when alcohol beat me up so badly that I had to come home and tell her, honey, you're married to an alcoholic. And she thought my problems were girls. I like girls. Scared of them, but I like them, you know. And they had a right to be afraid of me. And I didn't come to, I'd come in Alcoholics Anonymous, I found out really that they were just as afraid of me as I was. But I never knew that. You couldn't walk up to a girl and say, hey, honey, would you like to go out with a wimp? Because that's how I felt. I felt like a wimp. You can't say, honey, let's go out tonight. I'm a wimp. You know, she's going to say, get lost. You can't walk up to another guy and say, hey, look, dude, I feel less than you. Like, hey, you can't walk up to a guy and say that, I feel less than you. Because he's going to tell you, well, man, what you need to do is get your stuff together. And he never knew that's what I've been doing, trying to do all my life was get my stuff together. And every time I try to get my stuff together, it meant going back to jail. It meant going back to a nut war. So if you're new, if you're old, it's not about getting it together, I found out. Because if you're sitting here, you got it together. That's why you're here. Yeah. It's not about all that stuff that I thought was so necessary to live. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous the first time in 1950, and if you think you want to worry about how old I am, I'll tell you, I look good. I'm 70 years old, and I want to give you some new information that black don't crack. That's why it is. If you look, I'm just me, that's all. I get Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I don't worry too much. Because I found out that's a waste of time. Total waste of time for me to sit still and contemplate my neighbor with, one was going to. I know where I've been. I know where I am. And it's none of my business what's coming after that. You know, some people say, I don't know where I'm going. If I knew where I was going, I'd tell God to fix it. So I don't know, I'm going to fine. Just fine. Absolutely fine. And that's the most exciting thing in the world, not to know where you're going. Because you see, I love living on the edge. I love it. It's wonderful on the edge. You know. And I'm saying, wow, I could have died, never known this one. You know. And it's the most exciting thing in the world that I can stay sober. I don't worry about much of anything. I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that I've turned my will and my life over to the care of God, and He's the caretaker. Let Him do His job. Let Him do His job. I'm going to try to do what He wants me to do. Let Him do His job. He'll do it. Positive of that, He will do it because He has done it. I have the track record that tells me He does it for me if I just do what I'm supposed to do. I find out we have a business deal, if you will. You know, it's a 90-10 deal. I love that. Only difference is it's different than any business deal, you know. You see, because I'm the 10% and he's the 90%. And it makes it so easy to just do your little 10%. Don't drink, go to meetings, and help your brother. That's what you're supposed to do. Not climb the high mountain, not become a millionaire. Do something that's simple. Stay sober. Be of service to God and your fellow man. Be of service to your family. Be of service. That's what this thing is about. That's what I found. And the more I'm of service, the better I feel about me. The better I feel that my Father takes care of me because the track record tells me that. In 1950, I had been arrested 20 times. I had been in 4 nut wards. I had lost a wife with 2 children. And I stood before a judge. I heard Jack talk about Guadalcanal and the chaplain was down there. Well, I told the judge I was one of those sailors that was down at Guadalcanal fighting with Colonel Carlson's 2nd Marine Raiders. Now, I'd never been there, but the judge didn't know the difference. Because the judge at that point was about to sentence me to jail for a year. And at that particular time in my life, jail stopped looking good to me. Now, if you're like I am, the first time I went to jail, I was very indignant. How dare they arrest this black man and put him in jail when he's a newspaper reporter? You know, I had never written a story, but I was a newspaper reporter. You see, alcohol, I have found, changes your attitude. Now, by the 20th time I went to jail, I had begun to say, oh, hell, who doesn't go to jail once in a while? Altered attitude. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous does, too. It alters your attitude about you, about your fellow man, and about God's world. It alters your attitude. Spiritual, if you will, because that's what it says is in the big book. I'm not, you know, it's in the book. That's what it says. I used to hear people walking out there, I'm trying to live a spiritual life. I said, what are you talking about, spiritual life? And something spiritual happened to me. And when you've been born and heaped and steeped in religion like I was, see, I come from one of the Pentecostal religions where he just gave your life to Jesus all the time. You know, and they talked about, you know, I didn't know what to do with that stuff. You know, they said, and Jesus said this, and Jesus said that, and I wanted to know what mom and daddy said. Because I didn't know who Jesus was. And they said, well, I'm going to meet my maker way over yonder on the other side. Well, I could relate to that because I was having trouble right down here, you know. A lot of things didn't make sense to me when I was a kid, you know. And so when they start talking about spiritual, when I got sober, I thought they were going to pull out some tambourines and we could do some holy water stuff that I know so well. Because I knew all about religion and spiritual life because I had seen it lived in front of me. I would love to hold my mother and father hostage. I love to do that because I did it for a long time. If I hadn't been raised in that church, I wouldn't have been this way. If they hadn't done this or done that, I wouldn't have been this way. I wouldn't have been an alcoholic, you know? I'm an alcoholic because I drank alcohol. If you want to know how to become an alcoholic, you've got to drink alcohol. Now, that may be news, but that's what it is. Couple that with a spastic elbow and you're doomed. Now, I had a brother who lived in that house in, I guess, reasonable contentment. But not me. Not me. My brother, my father would say, I'm going to beat you, he'd faint. I'm the kid you had to be. And I wanted to do it and get it over with so I'd get back to what I needed to do. I hated it when they would say, I'm going to get you. And he'd wait. And I'm waiting for that thing to hit me. Do it and get it over. Don't put me in this kind of suspense. And he'd look at me and say, I'm going to get you. I mean, day in and day out. And I'd be doing one bad thing after another. And he'd promise me. And I'd say, why don't you do it? Let me get on with this stuff. And eventually he wouldn't. He wasn't too nice about it. He used to make me take all my clothes off and do it, beat me. The Bible says, spare the child, spare the rod, and spoil the child. And they'd hearken and hanker. That's what the preachers would do. Spare the rod. And the most amazing thing was that's how I passed the same stuff that my father did to me onto my children. I reacted to them the same way. I have a daughter. I may jump around tonight, but that's how it comes to me. I have a daughter. We're going to see her pretty soon in May. This girl was supposed to be, by our will, she was not supposed to be here. She was supposed to be aborted. But God saw fit to bring that girl here in spite of us. I mean, in spite of us. Because I'm a destructive human being. Make no bones about that. I'm destructive, sober as well as drunk. I'm almost 28 years sober, and I'm still a destructive human being. The difference is, in my life today, I own it. I no longer lie about it. And in accepting me as I am, because you have done that, enabled me to make different kinds of choices. Because that's all I want. I want a different choice. That's what I found out in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have to react in a manner to life in a manner that will kill me. I make a different choice. I cannot remove one defective character because I'm powerless. I have no power, none. I used to hear people with alcoholics and say, well, I'm working on this defect, and I'm working on that defect. Well, I tried it. And the sucker kept coming back. It had a new ribbon on it, but it was still the same one. And finally, I had to give up. And somebody pointed out, Milton, it says, we ask God to remove them, not Milton. Oh, yeah? That was like, where was I? Where was I when, and I read this book. Here I am trying to work on this defect. I remember distinctly. I remember what I could do when I first got sober. That was in 67. I found a quick, glaring character defect, lying. God, I could lie. And I said, aha, that's one thing I'd work on right away. Okay? I didn't know my life, my spiritual life had begun. I didn't know that. I thought, a lot of it comes after I do all these things, but I didn't know my spiritual life had begun. That was a change of attitude. That's when it began. Some people say, well, I'm waiting for it to happen. Baby, if you're here, it has happened. There is, you know, we walk around saying, well, I'm waiting for the miracle. If you're here, it's a miracle. You know, that's what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because drunk I'm supposed to be. And I sit here, and you sit here, and let some mealy-mouthed fart like me sit there and talk, and you sit there and look at me. But what you don't know and what I have found out, because you're willing to listen to me, I heal a little more. Because the healing isn't in the talking. The healing is in the listening. So my prayer is, God, make me a better listener. Not a better talker, a better listener. And that's hard if you're an alcoholic, because you know everything. It's hard to sit and listen. And I had to learn how to do that. It's not something just swept over me. I learned that from my wife, and she's an Al-Anon, and she's a... I was telling who, Paul? Or somebody today, you, Mike. Marry an Al-Anon, and the game's over. You can't run them games anymore. And she taught me about listening. I remember distinctly when she taught me the lesson. I had a knack of whenever you get me kind of pinned down and you're kind of cornering me a little bit, I have a knack of balling my fists up. And she would say, "You're going to hit me." I said, "No, I'm not. I'm ready." You know, and when they start at you, I just, come on now, and you can't find the answer to the first one. That's frustrating, you know, and you're trying to answer and there's more just piling on, and all at once you want to say, "Shut up! Let me answer the first one." And I remember this one time she said to me, "Milton, I got something I want to tell you." And she said, "But you get on that side of the bed, not get on this side of the bed." She put the bed between us. And she said, "What I want you to do is just listen to me. Don't defend it. Don't give me no excuses. And you don't have to change. Just listen." Let me tell you something. That was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. An alcoholic's no. And she said what she had to say, and I just want to say it. I just want to fix it. I want to just, you know, I want to come up with those excuses. But I listened. And I began to understand, because I could listen, I was forced to listen, she began to heal. And that's what I began to learn how to do, to listen, so that my fellow man can heal. Because if I knew the way, if I knew what you should do, I wouldn't be here in Alcoholics Anonymous. We seem to think that a sponsor knows everything. He's a drunk. Thank God, he's a drunk. You know? And you know, I don't sponsor people. I tell them I'll be your best friend. I ain't going to judge you. I'm not going to waste my time doing that, but I'll listen to you. And I'll share my experience with you. Now, you do whatever you choose to do. Because I don't know the way you should go. I know what I've had to do. And I'll support you even when you're wrong. And that's what I find it's all about. I can love that. Call that loving a person without condition. Unconditional love. That's what I've learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was talking about this daughter, Roseanne. I don't want to forget her. I'm going to let you know what I was like in sobriety. In sobriety. This same girl who was supposedly aborted, she got here. And I found myself chastising her just like my father did me. She would do things. They have a picture of Roseanne in a potty chair, asleep, where I was trying to force her to make poo-poo. And I look at that picture, at this child sitting there, and it just almost brings tears. But I was forcing this child. I was being a nasty daddy. That's what I was being. And I didn't know at that time that I was using some of the same stuff my father would use on me. And through the years, little by little, oh, she's a wonderful, beautiful daughter. She's now expecting her first child. And she's coming to see us in May. And she's coming so her mother and father, she lives in Chicago, she's coming to Vancouver for a grandmother's birthday party so that her mother and father can rub her belly. Rub that belly of that kid she's carrying around with her. You know, and I know today, without any shadow of a doubt, one more drink and I'd have missed it all. Just one more. You know. Anyway, we had this growing family life. I got here, they said, 1967. We had this family. I had to learn how to live. I didn't know how. I got a job. And the job was beneath me. Job I never would ever take. Because I had problems. I had big problems. You know, one of the problems I had is I didn't like being black. And it's obvious I was black. And I, because there was something bad about it. I didn't wear a hat. I'll tell you. It was just 3 years ago. But I started wearing a cap. And Ruby's telling me now she's going to bury me with a cap, you know. And I wouldn't wear a cap because my guys never wore caps. Out in the snow and all that kind of stuff, never wore caps. So I didn't wear a cap. Because I wanted to be like them. That's pretty difficult. But that's where I was. And the other thing I would do, I didn't want to get any handkerchief head jobs. Now, some of you may not know the expression, but that's a black expression. Handkerchief head job is a yassa boss job. Yassa. You know, you've seen the caricatures. Yassa. And, you know, pushing a broom. You know, just and say, yassa boss. The guy really bested an all-time movie actor, is one of the best. You're supposed. And I didn't want anybody to think of me that way. I read newspapers out loud. I saw my diction wouldn't be flat. I'm going to say no this, dim, dat, and those. I said this and them and that and those. I made sure you thought of me as being a different black. To make a long story short, when I surrendered the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the first thing God did for me is put a broom in my hand. And if you can imagine, I was in show business, and some people around the Hollywood area, they knew the group I was with and all that kind of bit. And can you imagine? Here I am walking down, pushing a broom down Santa Monica Boulevard, Mr. Showbiz. I'll tell you about that broom, though. Pushing a broom was not Milton. I've come to know that. I'm not a broom pusher. I know how to do it. And I began to slowly understand that God had given me that just simply to get me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's how any and all jobs ever took on with me in my life. It's designed to get me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not to get rich, but just get to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got here in 1967. The first guy I met was a guy named Wendell. I called him the other day. And Wendell 12-stepped me. And Wendell said to me, Milton, you can make it in this program. You can buy a simple concept. And that concept is that if you can understand that all you've ever learned in life, every plan, every scheme, your greatest thought you ever had, all those things brought you to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're totally invalid, will not work for you. He said, it might work for someone else, but it will not work for you. And of course, I was indignant about that. Here I'd been halfway around the world, entertaining thousands and thousands of people who just thought I was wonderful. And here's this guy telling me my genius had brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I always thought I was, I'm serious, I thought I was smart. You know, when you get broke, and I was born in New Jersey, when you get broke, rather than be broken, your genius mind says, go to New York and sell a pint of blood. That's smart. And I made it make sense. That's it. Jerked at me. And at first I was kind of indignant about it, but I thought one second more. You see, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with one thing I knew in mind. If I would be willing enough to do what these people told me, I could stay sober. I knew that going in because I had experienced Alcoholics Anonymous in 1950. I had the experience of taking a guy to the program, and he was still sober. And to me, he was Newark, New Jersey's worst drunk. But you see, I had to admit that I had to be willing to do what these people told me to do. Not believe it. Didn't matter. Some people come to Alcoholics Anonymous wanting to believe it works. You haven't got to believe it works. That's not a requirement. So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with that thing called willingness. And I thought that second, that 1 second, and I said, oh, he's right. I cannot put the word success behind my name. I could not say Milton Merle success, but I could put back there Milton Merle drunk. He had me because I had to be willing. And then he said to me, Milton, tell you something else. He said, stop listening to you. And because I'm a smart ass, you know, I said, well, who would I listen to? He said, everybody else except you. I said, well, what about my wife? He said, and her too. So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. He gave me some instructions. Stop listening to you. And I had to stop listening to me. You know, think. I didn't even apply that. I just didn't listen to me. See, I need simple stuff. I don't need stuff I got to figure out. He said something very simple. Then he said to me, Milton, why don't you just do what you see sober people do? And I said, okay. Just do what sober people do. I one time asked him, I said, well, you know, I might become a polyparrot. And he said, well, it's better to be a sober polyparrot than a drunk one, you know. They used finely honed razors when I came here. They just cut the ground out for Monday to keep you from dying, just slowly but surely. And you'd walk away, and you'd be maybe a mile or two away, and you'd feel the blood dripping in your hand. You know you've been had. That's how they treated you. Then he said something, you get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you do all these things, and you think you're just wonderful, you know, just so wonderful. You get sober, and you go into meetings, and God, you think you're doing great, you know? And you hear people say things in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you pick up the lingo. If you're new, there's a new lingo spoken here. It's a lingo that's not spoken in treatment centers. When you come from a treatment center, you have to start off at ground level for Alcoholics Anonymous. You start off at ground level because there's a new language spoken here. It is not clinical. It's one drunk talking to another. That's what this is about. And when I would hear all these words in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd hear people say wonderful things, and I'd put it in my little word register, and I got that, you know. You know, you pick up these little things, the more you pick it up, the more you feel like you're a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. You may not know how to use it, but you know you got it. You know. And I remember saying, once in a while I would venture with Wendell and say something I'd hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. He'd say to me, Milton, is it in the book? Because I can be flower mouth, believe me, I can be. He'd say, it's in the book. And when he'd say that, I'd have to go back and pick up the book and try to find out if it was there or if it wasn't there. That's how he got me into the book. I used to take the book when I first got sober, put it on my chest and go to sleep. You know, I hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous say, oh, I can't sleep. I tell them, read the book. When you know it, put you to sleep, you know. And they recorded me in by saying, well, nobody ever died of lack of sleep. You know. And I tell guys, read the book. They go to sleep. And then you complain about I can't sleep. But that's how I began reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I began reading that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and underlining the things that pertain to me. That's what I did. And I kept doing it. And I still do it. I want to tell you something. I read that book a lot. And 5 years ago, I was down in San Diego, California, with a friend that I'm working with today. And I had never talked in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous about living a spiritual life because I didn't know what it was. I really didn't know what it was. And I'd hear people say, I'm living a spiritual life. I didn't know what it was because I hadn't been able to refine it for Milton, to put it in a place that Milton could feel that in him. And I was reading the book, and on page 25 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have seen this page over and over and over again. And when God saw fit, he let my eyes see what Alcoholics Anonymous refers to as a spiritual way of life. I used to hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous say, AA stands for altered attitude. I never related that to being spiritual, but that's what it is. The book said so. So it takes its own time. You see when you see. You know when you know. And you can't rush this process. You know, I'd love to go to one of them fix-it doctors. That you sit there and lay on the couch and he fixes it. I'd love to go to that, but I know I would lie to him, I would take him and I'd turn him around, I'd challenge him like that. So I don't want to rush the process. I'm gonna let it happen the way God wants it to happen. Because I'm God's kid. And God don't want anything but the best for me, I'm sure of that. And now in our lives, in our home, in our lives, we try to live the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous as well as others. We had to tell our daughters, I had to tell, we have another one, Chrissy's 24 years old, right? She's crazy. She's crazy, I love her, she does nothing she can be. Feet planted firmly in midair. Yeah. She's adorable. She's absolutely, she could walk in this room. And she has such a presence about her, she can walk right up to you because she's been around AA and Al-Anon. She can walk right up to you and say, my name is Christy Murr. And you'd love her just from the minute because she's so much effervescence about her. And she just captivates you. You know? And she's so full of BS, it's unbelievable. You know? And she'd tell you quick. Because she knows, I know, I'm full of BS too. And she knows it. And I understand where she's coming from, you know. And, you know, we've had to let go, and it's difficult to let go. We've had to tell those, I had to tell them, I don't know, Ruby's told them over and over again. I had to tell them, I don't know how to be a daddy. You know, when they're 13, they're crazy anyway. They don't fit anywhere. They just dangle. And when you're dangling, you're nothing. See, my problem is I forgot when I was 13. When I was 13, I found some Dago red wine. It growed me up in a hurry, you know. But they don't have any track shoes to run in, so they're nuts. I remember Roseanne was seeing, to me, her first boyfriend. And he was different. he was just the opposite. His mother and father's situation, just the opposite of what ours was. You know, his father was Chinese and his mother was black. You know, and it was just the opposite of what we were. And that's what they had in common. And he ran on a skateboard. I wouldn't talk to it. Because all I knew, I just knew it beyond any shadow of a doubt, someday she's going to get pregnant and come home and say, Daddy, here it is. And my head would say, well, what do the people in Alcoholics Anonymous think about us as a family? That's where my head was. And I did this over. She'd come in and I wouldn't talk to her. Ruby was trying to get me to be friendly with the little kid. I wouldn't talk to him. She had us go to lunch. And I wouldn't even, I didn't act like he existed, poor guy, you know. And that's all they had in common. It was the boyfriend-girlfriend situation. They had something they could akin to kinship that they had. That's all they had. But here I am in my head, rating her like I would rate myself. I used me as a yardstick. And one day, when I just had about as much of it as I could handle, when I began to realize that I had done with her what alcohol had done with me. Whenever I drank alcohol, it predicted the conduct of my life. When I plugged into people, and I'm a great one for walking around with that umbilical cord hanging out and plug in. They predicted my life. They predicted the happiness and the sadness. I gave them power, and they never asked for it. I gave them power over me. And I realized that I was giving Roseanne power over my life. So I had to sit her down and get honest. And I had to tell Roseanne, I don't know how to be a father. And I said, maybe if you teach me how to be your kind of father, maybe we can make it. And that was a big breakthrough for me. Because she began to teach me how to be her kind of father. And this is the most magnificent thing in the world. I remember telling her, you know, my name is Milton. I said, you can call me Milton. She said, oh, no, Daddy, I can call you Milton. Oh, I can't do that. And about 2 weeks later, she walked in the house. She said, hey, boy. And it was okay. Let me tell you what it felt, because I'll never forget the feeling. When she walked in the house and said that, my chest just seemed to want to explode. She had found safety. She had found safe. She was safe enough to risk. And that's what the program did for us. I did the same thing with Chrissy. And Chrissy, because she's a blasé kind of a kid, she told me, oh, Daddy, you don't need any instructions. You know how to be a daddy. I said to her, Chrissy, write it down on a piece of paper for me, please. If you have seen it, I have. I haven't seen it yet. But that's Chrissy. But the amazing thing about it is that I was then able to be able to be a friend. Not equal, but a friend. I would take each one out to dinner, just the two of us. I wouldn't take them both together. I knew better than that. And I began to see the difference in my two daughters. Roseanne, when she would order food, they would order food for me. They would give me what they wanted me to eat. That's how they would order it. And the bill, Roseanne's bills, would always be much less than Chrissy's. Because Chrissy's much like me. She's flamboyant, you know. And she just orders, and it's at least $10 to $15 more when Chrissy and I would go to dinner. But the amazing thing about it, you know, I used to lay in my bedroom, in our bedroom, and Ruby would be in the room with the girls. And they'd be just chattering. I'm saying, what are you laughing about? You know, and I'd feel left out. I'd feel left out. I'd say, God, why can't I be that way? Why can't we get in the room and just laugh? I couldn't do that. But the amazing thing about it, God found the way for me to get closer. And we'd go out and have dinner. And then they would tell me everything I wanted to hear. Any questions I had about what their life was like, what their school life was like, I would tell them the truth. I had to be willing to let them show me how, because I didn't know how. It worked for me that way with those two girls. I told Ruby, I know how to be a husband. Show me how, and that's chancy. When you are married to a person who has a way to go, they don't mind telling you. They will tell you in no uncertain terms. And you got to not worry about the tone of the voice. Because if the tone of the voice, it'll get me. It'll get me if you come with it loud, because it scares me. What I've had to look is at the content. It's what she has said, is it right? And when it's right, I got to own it. That's the difference. I got to own it. Not defend it, just own it. To be able to say, you know, you're right. Because otherwise, before then, if you raise your voice, I got to deal with your voice, not the right or the wrongness of it. And that's the way our lives began to mesh. Because she began to be free enough to share her feelings. And little by little, because she shared hers, I would risk sharing mine. Because I knew if I shared my feelings, it might disturb something. It might cause something or some pain somewhere. But you see, she had taught me a long time ago to be able to share and not defend. And our lives began to get closer and closer together. I've had heart attacks. She's been there. You see, God sent Ruby to me in Portland, Oregon, 32 years ago. More than that, 33 years ago. It was God's gift to me. And I've come to know an Alcoholics Anonymous. She is God's messenger to me. Because she sees me like I don't see myself. Sometimes when you're sober and you're trying to live this program on a daily basis in every area of your life, And God, you think you're going 90,000 miles now. You've got it together. You know, you just AA and back. Just doing this AA thing. And she's standing over the corner saying, well, you're not so hot. I want to know what that not so hot is. Because I have a disease of perception. I see myself one way, and others see me the other way. And so in my mind, you're God's messenger to me. I want to know how you see me. Because I'm a guy that's full of illusions. I'm just full of illusions. I ain't the hot crap I think I am. I ain't the soberest guy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a guy that's still trying to stay sober one day at a time, good, bad, or indifferent. And I need you. I need you to tell me what I'm about. How do you see me? I know people leave, well, I'm going from this home group to another home group. I don't want to do that. I want to stay with that group because they saw me when I came in, and they said, well, the group's not doing the way I want it. Stay there and get it back to the way you'd like to have it. You don't run from groups. You don't get mad, well, they don't do it my way. I don't like the way they're doing. You have a right in that group. They saw you get there. I want them to know that I'm there because when I got my head up my butt, I want somebody to pull my coat and say, Milton, your head's up your butt. Get it out. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and it just bothers me to see people flop from group to group to group to group. You know? And that, it just bothers me because that group needs you. That's why you're there. And you need to be there. I've been in groups where it just change over and over and over, and somebody says, well, you stay there anyway. So I stayed there through these changes. I let them know how I felt and stayed there anyway. The strange thing, I go to a crazy wild group in Canada. They're nuts. They're just crazy. I'm the oldest guy there, and of course, my head, which has a contract on my butt, believe me when I tell you, says to me, they're too loud. You're sober now. I've been made the alternate delegate. And my head says, well, you're the alternate delegate. You should be in a group that's more involved in service. Now, I'm the oldest member there of that group. I've been sober longer than anybody else in that group. I got shamed into being there. Just shamed into it. I have one of these loud, you know, these young, loudmouth, eager beaver alcoholics. His name is Ron. He used to say to me, well, Mel, when are you going to join my group? And I said, well, I've been sober a while. Don't you tell me to join a group? I know to join a group. I wanted to shut up. But every time I'd see him, he'd open that mouth of his up. And so just to keep his mouth shut, I joined the group. But you know, my head says you don't need to be there now because you're this and you're that. Now, I remember an old friend of mine came up from Southern California, and he said to me, Milton, you know, leaving groups is easy. But one thing for sure, it's better to stay where you need. And I needed that group. It's just that something. I needed it. Because if God wants me to rule that group, He will do that. I won't. Something I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. Let God remove me, not me. You know? And I know through experience, God will place me where He wants me to be. Not where I ought to be, should be, or could be, but just where He wants me to be. So I can be a man who has started as a program. He does main events. And he's asked me to come out and just share about serving others. The things that I've learned to do serving people. I've served people in business. And the wonderful reward of serving others. And where did I learn it? I learned it here in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I learned it. And it's the most wonderful thing. I've had to... I don't want anybody to get the impression that I've gotten so well. I haven't gotten so well. I'll tell you a little incident. Not too long ago, he gave me a $5,000 bonus. And my first reaction, oh, you can't do that. You cannot do that. I want to give it back to him. I want to, and I just went through a whole litany of, I'm just here to help you, blah, 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 blah. And I came down and I told Ruby about it, and she said, Milton, did you say thank you? And in the, just that little bit, what I wanted to do, and he wouldn't let me do it, I wanted to grovel at his feet. He said, that's what I'm like. Today, that's what I'm like. I'd rather grovel and say, oh, my God, you're so wonderful. His answer to that money he gave me was, I'll either have to give it to you or Uncle Sam. Simple. But I'd rather grovel. And I became aware that's the kind of human being I am. Not that I can change it. It's about finding out who and what I am and what kind of an individual I am. Now I've got to make friends with it. Not change it, just make friends with it. As my friend of mine used to say, make love to it. And the strangest will happen to me. I won't have to grovel anymore. I'll be able to say thank you, because it's really, I don't know how to receive. I don't know how to receive. I love giving, but I don't know how to receive. And that's something I've had to learn about, become aware of. To simply say thank you. You know when you have a dress on or coat, and somebody says, oh my God, that you sure look good in that suit. Oh, well, it's an old thing. That's what I'm like. And I've come to know that, little by little. I could talk on and on about Alcoholics Anonymous, but Ruby told me not to talk too long. Ruby is my higher power, and it's all right. I always tell people, Ruby wants to be the leader, and I say, lean on, honey. See, because I don't want to be a leader. I might act like I want to be a leader, but I don't want to be a leader. I might act like I want to be responsible, but I don't want to be responsible. I didn't come in this world being responsible. Somebody took care of me. That's why the program works so well. God, yes, sir, right now. Because I love being taken care of. I don't like to be the leader. And I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, if she wants to lead on, honey, I'm right behind you. Yeah. It's okay. So all this stuff about being a man and being a leader brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not about being a man. It's not about being a leader. It's about simply, as my deceased friend Chuck used to say, it's simply about being. About being. And that's why I try to keep my life focused into simply being. Not good, not bad, just to be. And to be able to be where I am and accept that fight. I'm the most wonderful man I've ever been in my life. You know, until I had the chance to kind of move up a mountain, sit way up on the top of the mountain for a little while, and I could look down in the valley where I came from and found there was no difference with you down in the valley than me on top of the hill, then things got okay. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous wanting to be different, and then I realized I walked into a room where everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous who gets here wants to be different. It has nothing to do with the color of my skin. I just didn't like what I was. And little by little, by trying to live this program as best I can, the differences have been removed. And today, the language in Alcoholics Anonymous are two simple words. Because I love being unique, and I know my uniqueness will kill me. But the two words that are most important to me in Alcoholics Anonymous is me too. Me too. You may say, well, I've been to jail 10 times. Somebody will come along and say, yeah, well, me too. Somebody will say, I've been married 5 times. And somebody will say, yeah, well, me too. Alcoholics Anonymous, if you stay around here long enough, will steal your uniqueness away from you, because it's your uniqueness that will kill you. I am not different. We're all the same. There's no difference in my feelings or a female. None at all. Because feelings are feelings. Feelings have no gender. When you're inadequate, there's no female inadequacy or male inadequacy. You're just inadequate. You know, when you're scared, there's no female fear or male fear. You're just scared. And the best thing you can do is own it. Because I walked around paralyzed with fear. And I came here. And you began to help me replace that fear with faith. That God could and would if sought. You did not tell me to find him. Just seek him. And somewhere along the way, he claimed me. He really claimed me. Because I've tried my best to align my will with God's will. And as a result of that, I always finish with this. I'm not going to stop now. I usually talk about freedom. I'm freer today than I've ever been in my life. I'm free of the enemy. That's me. And in that, I have found the hero, and that's me too. There's an old song in slavery they sang, and the words of the song go like this. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me, my Lord. And before I'll be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. Those old slaves knew, picking those cotton balls out there in the sun, and all they could hear was excerpts from the Bible from the master who would be delivering the sermon in the church, and the back door would be open so he could see who was working and who wasn't working. And their song was, let me be free. Before I pick another ball of cotton, I'd rather be dead and buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. Because they knew where God was, freedom was. Martin Luther King finished one of his many speeches with this. He said, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, I'm free at last. Thank you.
I'm extremely grateful for that.
Good morning, I am Derek, and I am an alcoholic. That's for those of you that don't know me. For those of you that do, let the tape record show that I was able to bow with grace and dignity. Let's see, what am I here for? I'm here to tell you about myself. That's the only thing I can do with at least any sort of reliability. I will start up by telling you that I wore my boots today. After sitting there last night watching the speaker, I figured, oh, I better wear something high this morning so I'd at least be taller than the podium. It worked. Most things do when I give them a try. I guess what I'm supposed to do is tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And there's a lot of information in there, and I can't possibly cover it in an hour, so I'll just sort of pick out a few tidbits here and there. I come from a sort of lower middle class family, born in Omaha, moved away from there in a hurry. My family background was one of sort of, I would call it a moderate amount of the standard abusive behavior. With my mother standing there hitting me with a 2x2. And then after I was sort of numbed a bit and out of bed, I discovered that it was because I had taken a fence post out of the creek behind our house. And I thought, okay, I really must be pretty rotten to have done something that, you know, taking a fence post deserves being beaten. So I learned in a hurry that what they told me must have been right. That I was stupid, that I was ugly, and that I would never amount to anything. Now, I've kind of, over the years, found that if you tell an adult something about 187,000 times, they'll believe it. Tell a child the same thing twice, and they know it's absolutely the truth. Throughout my entire career of living with my family, that was pretty much what things were like. My mother married my stepfather when I was, I think it was 6 or 7. I was 7. And before I was 10, I ended up in the hospital 8 times because I was a clumsy child. I fell down a lot, as all abused children do. We fall a lot. We never get beaten. I remember just a few years ago telling one of my grade school friends about some of the occurrences in our household, and he absolutely didn't believe it. at first. And I said, well, why would you not believe it? And he said, because your mother was so nice and your stepfather was so nice, they wouldn't have done that. I said, but that's the whole thing with a family that has abuse going on. Everybody's very nice publicly. There's that private life behind the closed doors where it's not quite so pretty. That a lot of what they told me just wasn't true. As far as my drinking career, that was interesting. See, I would never do anything wrong. I mean, I couldn't because I knew I would get beat up for it. So I didn't have my first drink till my 21st birthday. Unlike most of the kids that I knew. I went to a bar that was fairly close to where I lived. Anybody know where the Saddle Creek Bar in Omaha is? Well, they should have put a plaque up there for me. That was where I had my very first drink, and I got drunk. And I stayed that way for, 21 to 33, 12 years. I didn't ever bother to sober up during that time. I'd wake up in the middle of the night and have a few beers and go back to sleep. I used to think that there were reasons for why I drank, that I drank to forget things, to forget the abuse, to forget that I was stupid, ugly, and would never amount to anything. And I thought that I drank so that I could pretend that I wasn't those things, so that I could pretend that I was a worthwhile person. I used to think that I drank because that was the only way that I knew how to catch a man. And it was to get drunk and become obnoxious until they would take me to bed to get me off their case. But what I finally figured out was, hey, it worked. What I finally figured out was that I drank because I was addicted to alcohol. It was as simple as that. I drank because I couldn't stop. I drank because I had to. That for me to function, I had to have alcohol in my system. There's a lot of things that I could tell you about what happened while I was drinking, but most of those are pretty irrelevant. I was a typical, sloppy, disgusting drunk. One of the primary memories that I have is when I was in college, which I didn't start till I was 26, I remember walking across campus one day with $1 in my pocket, and I was crying and crying and crying and asking the question, why me? Why did I have to be like this? I hadn't eaten for a day or so, but I knew that I would not be able to avoid spending that last dollar on a six-pack of beer. And that's what they were then, for cheap beer. It was 99 cents. And that was very typical of me and very typical of my behavior, to be crying whenever I was drinking. In fact, I was crying so much that the government tried to have my face declared federal wetlands. It was just getting worse and worse every day. And I could tell that things were getting worse, but I also knew that I couldn't quit. I could tell in different ways, like the people that I was hanging around with. I initially hung around with a lot of social users, people that could have a couple of drinks, and that was it, and, you know, nothing more to worry about. And pretty soon there were people who were drunk a lot. And then there were people who were drunk all the time. And then there were people that I didn't know. Because if I hung around, if I would find new people, people that I didn't know, they didn't know me and they didn't know what a sloppy drunk I was. And they would put up with me for a day or two. Well, as you can imagine, there came a time when I was with the wrong people at the wrong time. And I ended up getting arrested for the crime of sodomy, which was real thrilling. Ended up in prison, and I did my time there and was very comfortable there in a strange sort of a way. I always knew where my next meal was coming from. I always knew I would have a bed to sleep in. But at the same time, I was scared half to death. And then I started realizing that for me, being afraid was afraid of everything. I was afraid of being rejected by every human being that ever drew a breath because I was being rejected by myself. I finally had my belief system validated in that I was no good one day when I was severely beaten and stabbed and raped by seven very large men. And yet at the time it was no big deal because they just simply proved to me that I was the piece of shit that I thought I was. Then came the day that I got out. And when I walked out the door of that place, I said, by God, I'll never drink again. I know I never will. Because I can't go through with that. I had to say that. I had to say that because that's what people expected to hear from me. That I couldn't cope with it, I couldn't go back there and all that sort of stuff. And for the first couple hours, I didn't drink. They had a coming home lunch for me, and I thought, one glass of wine will not hurt me. I will not get back into it because I'm not going to drink beer. I'm going to drink a smart little glass of wine to celebrate my getting out of prison. So I had a glass of wine, and I was fine for the rest of the afternoon. And at the coming home party that night, somebody brought a keg of beer, and another one brought a few cases, and on and on. I drank a case of beer that night, and cried, and cried, and got lots of attention. It was because I was in so much pain from having been in prison, and oh, poor me, God. Well, I was in pain, but it wasn't from being in prison. And it wasn't too long after that that I hit my first of several treatment centers. I went into a treatment center for an evaluation, and this is what I was told. Excuse me, you have a lot of problems, but drinking is definitely not one of them. Did I need a better excuse than that? Not on your life. I left the treatment center on the 10th day, which was, I was there for a 10-day evaluation, and there's this liquor store right down at the end of the driveway. I hit that place on the way home. Stayed drunk some more. As you can imagine, I did have to have some sort of way to support myself. And so I would go from one job to another job to another job because they all figured out that I was an alcoholic. Well, actually, I don't know if they figured that out or just that I was sick because I was always sick. I couldn't come in today because I had the flu. Next week, I can't come in today because I have diarrhea or a stomachache or a toothache or, you know, I'm just the lizard job milking cows. And I told my boss that I was an alcoholic and that he had to make sure that every day I took my little anabuse pills because I was going to go that route. And he said, you can't possibly be an alcoholic because you're never late to work. I started work at 7:30 in the morning, and who in the hell had to be late? I was passed out by 8 o'clock at night, so I didn't have to worry about being late. It was just one of those things. Well, the way that job ended was, in a blackout one day, I left. I don't remember leaving. What I remember is going into town to run some errands. It was right before Christmas. The next thing I knew, I was getting out of a van in a city that I didn't know, and it turned out to be Chicago. How I got there, I'm not sure. I think I hitchhiked. Hitchhiking was absolutely not okay in my book. Only sleazy people hitchhiked. They were too poor to have a car, and I had a car. But apparently that's how I got there. Well, when I got back to Omaha, I started retracing my footsteps and found out that a lesbian friend of mine had asked me if she could borrow my car to take her lover to the hospital who had fallen on the ice and broken her leg. I gave her the title, signed it, and said, keep this son of a bitch. I don't need it anymore. I don't give nothing to nobody, especially a woman. Well, now to the next subject. Sex. That was, it's not something that I'm very comfortable talking about, but that's okay, I will. It tells a lot about me, and it tells a lot about my drinking. I'm one of those fortunate people who knew that I was gay right from the time I was a child. I had my first lover when I was 8, but that's okay. He was an older man. He was 8 and a half. He was also my best friend. We also shared the same last name. By the time we were in high school, he was voted the best-looking boy in our school. He was bright, he was witty, he was charming, he was everything that I wanted to be, but I knew I wasn't. And I spent years saying, how did I ever get my hands on somebody like this? What could he possibly see in me? Well, then we broke up when I was 21. And as I said, on my 21st birthday, I had my first drink. By the time I was 21 years and a week, I found my first gay bar. And I discovered this strange little thing there, that some of the people didn't yet realize how ugly I was. And I was toting tricks out of this bar like it was, you know, going out of style. And the manager of the bar got incredibly pissed at me because I kept taking the men that he wanted. Well, I was this little tiny fart. I mean, I didn't quit growing until I was 26, so I was really quite tiny and cute and innocent looking and all of these sorts of things, so I was able to grab almost any man I wanted. I'd find a way. I'd buy them. I thought they wanted to be some big butch thing. I'd let them buy me a few drinks and then take them home. And it became one of those things where I could say, well, he wanted me, at least for an hour. And they all wanted me for an hour. But it didn't take long for them to realize that I was too disgustingly drunk to be around for more than an hour. And in bed, I would generally keep my mouth shut. And it didn't take too long before that wore off. Maybe 6 months before the cute stopped working. But then I made this discovery that if I wore certain clothes and acted in a certain way, some of these men would take me home and beat me up. And I worked very hard at getting only the ones that would beat me up. To the point where, to this day, I haven't forgotten it, neither has the owner's wife of a particular bar in Omaha, which shall remain nameless. I allowed them one night to hang me up from some chains dangling from the ceiling with nothing on and do anything they wanted to me. And they proved I was no good. They proved that I deserved abuse and that I deserved to be treated badly. It was like I was in heaven because I was right. For the first time in my life, I was absolutely right, and these men were proving it, that I was absolutely no good. Initially, I had at least certain standards that I would only, you know, like if I were to rate all men on a 1 to 10 scale, I would only go home with somebody that was an 8 or above. And then pretty soon it was a 5 or above. And I got to the point where a 1 would do. Anyone would do. One experience that will never hopefully leave my mind was that I woke up one morning and didn't know that I had brought someone home with me, and I rolled over in bed and I screamed. This man was, how would I describe him? Unbelievably obese. And there was not one square inch of his body that wasn't covered. Me, he was physically very ugly. He was repulsive. And I would never, on a sober day, have said yes to him. But then after I screamed, I realized how badly I must have made him feel. And at that point, I don't think I cared. All I wanted to do was figure out a way to get him out of my house. And he woke up charming and nice and wouldn't leave. He finally did. Well, it was about a week or 2 weeks after that I was sleeping under the West O Street Viaduct in Lincoln. And I came out of a blackout in the middle of the night, and there was some 60-plus-year-old wino there, and I was begging him to let me suck his dick. That was the night I checked into my first treatment center. I figured that was as low as I could sink. But it apparently wasn't as low as I could go because I didn't stay sober. And then I went to another treatment center and another one and another one until I had them through five different treatment centers six different times. Well, surprisingly enough, it never worked. I now know why it didn't work, because I went for almost every reason and everybody but me. I was not ready to quit yet. When I finally did, well, I got started going to AA meetings in Lincoln, and I discovered that it would work very, very well there. I could do things like go to the meeting, and you know how you act like you put in $5 and take out $4? Well, I used to do that every week so I could go get drunk. And then I figured two or three times a week, I could go in and act like I put in 5 or 10 and take out change. I mean, they'd pass that little pot full of money. I couldn't resist that. Not when my stomach needed some beer. And, of course, I had to get drunk in order to steal the money to get drunk again. Well, so, I don't know. It managed to work. But when I finally quit, what happened was I had been going to meetings for 3 years and claiming sobriety because I had not drank. I was smoking dope, I was shooting, I was snorting a little of this and that and what have you, but I did not drink. I went to the Alano Club at home and I told everybody how to stay sober. And funny thing, they were. It was where everything I said seemed to be just magical for them. One woman one night was sitting in a meeting bitching because her ex-husband wouldn't pay any attention to her kids, and on she went. And I just looked at her and I said, "Girl, the fuck don't make a father." And she remembered that. I forgot it, but she remembered it. One of the things that kept her sober was hearing that. And I'm going, "Oh, okay, well, isn't that nice? I'm so glad I was able to help." Well, you know, here this time is going by, and I'm truly, at this point, despising myself, because I'd go out on the porch, smoke a joint, and go back in and collect another medallion. Because I wasn't drinking. I didn't have to drink. I had my weed, I had my everything else. And I couldn't face those people unstoned, because I had a secret. And they didn't know what the secret was. Well, I can claim that I've had one of the world's finest planned drunks, because it worked. I knew at that time that because of my mouth and because of saying all the right things that nobody would believe I was using, I knew it. So what I did was, I went to a meeting one night and I got pissed because I tried to tell them that I was using drugs and they wouldn't believe me. So I went home, and on the way home I bought 2 6-packs of beer. Took them home, sat down, and I drank 1 6-pack just as quickly as I could, and I called up this woman that I knew would call up my sponsor and tell him. Called her up and said, "Hey, I'm drunk." And she goes, "Oh." So she called up my sponsor. Some of the people in this room know him. Well, the two of them came over to my house, and we had a discussion. And I said, "I'm sick and tired of living." And here's what they said to me. "No, you're not." And I said, "Don't tell me I'm not. I am." They said, "No, you're not sick of living. You're sick of living the way you have been." And they were right. And from that minute on, I've not ever wanted to have a drink again. I'm not sure of exactly why, other than to say they were right. I was sick and tired of living the way I had been. I did manage to stop drinking. I don't know for sure what all was going on with me at that time, because I was still, I was numb for the first couple of years. But I remember that on my first anniversary, I thought, "My God, this has been so easy to stay sober." And yet I remember walking down the street and in tears again, because I wasn't getting any attention for staying sober. I got a lot of attention when I was drunk. All negative, but I got a lot of it. And that night, I went home to discover a surprise sobriety party for me. And I thought, "My God, these people do care." And I was stunned that they cared about me even though I was not drunk. They cared about me enough to not chase me away. That They told me that I was okay. I didn't believe them yet, but they told me I was okay. I knew I still had a few unfold. And during the first few years, what I learned how to do was stay sober. I didn't learn how to live. I didn't learn how to quit lying. I didn't learn how to stop keeping secrets. But eventually, I did start learning those things, too. Because the one thing I learned was that if I keep secrets, I'll go right back to drinking. Because I started thinking back to all the behaviors that happened. For the first four times I was in treatment, I was told, don't tell anybody you're gay. And I didn't. I left and got drunk. It was easier. The fifth and sixth times that I was there, I said, no, I have to tell them that. But I still kept a lot of other secrets. I couldn't tell anybody about the abuse that went on in my house. Abuse only happens to rotten people. I knew that, so I couldn't tell that. There were just so many things I couldn't tell. Well, after the first year or so of staying sober, I started telling people, little by little, what had happened to me, what I had lived through. And I kept finding out that I was hardly the only one, that I wasn't the only kid in the world that got beat up. And I wasn't the only one who was told that they were stupid and ugly and would never amount to anything. By the time I had been sober about 5 years, I started thinking maybe, just maybe, I was starting to see some success in my life. Well, that was scary, but I said, I'm going to try something. I'm going to go back to school. And I went to school to learn how to be a computer programmer. $5,000 wasted. But I didn't know that. I really thought I wanted to do that. So I went to this school, and three-quarters of the way through it, I discovered, no, I don't want to do this ever as an occupation. But I finished it. I finished that school, and I graduated, and I got my little diploma, and I still have that sucker at home. Never used it, but I finished it. That's all I cared about. So then I turned around. I was out of that school maybe a month when I went back to school. I went to beauty school, like all good little princesses should do. For those who haven't, anybody in here gone there? Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, I discovered I was good at it. It was a little hard to conduct this balancing act of doing some old lady's hair one day and going out and milking cows and shoveling shit the next day. But I managed. I didn't smell too bad on these days, and I didn't offend the cows on these days. And it went very, very well. I got out of school, and immediately I got a job in one of the more prestigious places in town, and everything was going great. And I decided to move to California. And I did. I talked to a friend of mine out there and made arrangements to move. I packed my bags, and I was gone. And about 3 weeks after I was there, at this point I'd been sober like 6 years, a little over 6 years. Once I got out there, I started job hunting, but I couldn't do very well at job hunting there because I didn't feel well. I didn't feel at all well. Pretty soon I couldn't walk. And then I was having all these other problems. And I thought, okay, now I'm going to die. And all I could think of at the time was, God, let me stick around long enough to be sober 10 years. Just 10 of about 6 months. And I looked at this doctor and I said, sucker, you don't know me very well. By this time, I had been sober about 6 years and I'd learned how to be a little bit stubborn. Just ever so slightly. Stubborn enough that it's gotten me through 6.5 years of dealing with that shit stuff. Now, a lot of people don't understand when I tell them this, but I will tell you the same thing I tell everybody else. Getting AIDS has been the second best thing to ever happen to me in my life. I love it. But not for the... Prior to it, I had lost my family, most of my friends, because I drank my way through them. I had lost just enough stuff that, yeah, I was sober, but I wasn't very happy. And when I got this diagnosis, I had to stop and evaluate a few things, like which is worth more, the diamonds or the family? Which is worth more, the new car or the friends? And I started realizing that all the things in the world didn't mean shit. But my family meant a lot to me, and I needed to find a way to get them back. Well, I found it. My friends meant as much to me as my family because they had become my second family. And I've gotten a lot of them back. Getting that kind of a diagnosis is like getting slapped in the face with a hell of a good dose of reality. You know, reality being that we are human beings. We are mortal. We can't do a damn thing about our past. But we can sure as hell do something about our present and our future. Being in AA, I had learned all these things like, I am powerless. Well, I am over alcohol. My life had become unmanageable. It was a mess. But then I had to turn around and rewrite part of that step when it came to my AIDS diagnosis. I am not powerless over AIDS. I am powerless over the fact that I already have it, and I am powerless over the outcome of it. But boy, can I give the interim a lot of good direction. If it's based on everything that I've learned from the AA program, it works well. I learned without any shadow of a doubt what living life one day at a time means. Not just doing it, but me as my family, because they had become my second family. And I've gotten a lot of them back. Getting that kind of a diagnosis is like getting slapped in the face with a hell of a good dose of reality. You know, reality being that we are human beings. We are mortal. We can't do a damn thing about our past. But we can sure as hell do something about our present and our future. Being in AA, I had learned all these things like, I am powerless. Well, I am over alcohol. My life had become unmanageable. It was a mess. But then I had to turn around and rewrite part of that step when it came to my... I had spent every spring and every fall in tears because I had had to leave the farm because of a number of reasons. Drinking was only part of it. So what did I do? I went out and bought myself a couple of calves. Now I've got some to take to the fair, and I can show them, and that's why I was tired when I got here the other day. But I can do that, because I choose to do that. You know, it fits in with my program. It fits in with making me happy. Because I tell you, if I don't make myself happy and do what I can for me, I can't do anything for anybody else. Because I've learned, partly because of my life in AA and my life with AIDS, how incredibly precious life is, even when you're having a shitty day. You know, one of those days where it's like, well, it's like the other day. I mean, everything in my life was going wrong. I got my windshield busted yesterday. I got robbed just down the street, not too far. This man jumped in my car and stuck a gun to my head, and he got my money. Thank God I wasn't wearing any jewelry and he didn't shoot me. But he got what he wanted, and I got scared enough to think I was going to wet my pants. I didn't, but it wouldn't have been any surprise. I mean, I've had a few shitty days, but not in a string, not like they used to be. And even on shitty days, I'll find something to feel good about, because if I don't, then why bother? You know, it's like, I sobered up not to be perfect. I sobered up to be normal. And what I frequently forget is that normal is okay. Especially when I see a lot of my friends not accepting normality. And that normal does not mean... I'm not always, but I am always normal. I have ups, I have downs. I mean, I am absolutely always normal. There's been an incredible amount of gifts in my life that come from staying sober. These days I am so busy I can't see straight half the time, which is wonderful. because I know that I have the jobs that I have to do. I know that I have enough intelligence, see, I'm not stupid, to do the things I need to do, to make me happy and to keep body and soul together. I'm very, very successful at the things that I need to be successful at. One is staying sober for something over 5,000 days. You know, that's a hell of a success for me, because I couldn't stay sober for 5 seconds before. I'm successful with my businesses. I have two. You know, I can't be satisfied with one. I have two. I spend my time with things that are important to me. I have a 3.5-year-old grandson that, I mean, he is fabulous. This kid, tell you a little story about him, and this, one of the proudest days of my life was on my birthday last year. He was 2.5 at the time, and we were in a restaurant, and this kid stands up and starts singing Happy Birthday to me in this restaurant, and people are looking at him, and he turns around and he goes, I love my grandpa. I sat there with tears running down my face, and this whole audience that this kid had was applauding. Well, that kid does love me, and he's not the only one. So do I. And I learned a lot of that from him. You know, I learned from this child things about me that I didn't even know were possible. I learned that I can be the big person. I can be the adult. You know, I didn't know that. Even after years of sobriety, I didn't know that. I've learned that I can be positively stubborn. And I am very stubborn, hopefully in a positive way. I'm stubborn enough that on the last four occasions when they told me I would probably die within a couple of weeks, I said, you know me better than that by now. I'm still around. I still fight. Stand absolutely that if I work this program, I will stay sober. Absolutely. For today. I've learned that the expression live and let live has another part to it, and that's give and let give. It's very easy for me to give to somebody else. It's very hard for me to let someone else give to me on an emotional or personal level. And I'm learning that it's okay for me to be a giving person, but it's okay for me to let someone give to me too. Kind of surprised me when that hit, but it did hit. I know exactly what is meant now by easy does it, because I'm able to catch myself overdoing it lots of times. There is absolutely no similarity between my life now and my life 13 years ago. I don't feel like the same person, and I, even though I know I have the same body, I don't have the same soul. That part of me has changed, and it will stay the way it is now and grow. That I don't have to go back to that. I way back when said that I had not wanted to drink. There was one time for 2 seconds that I wanted to have a drink. I was on my way home from a friend of mine's funeral, and at his funeral I heard all these lies about him. I heard that he died from cirrhosis of the liver. No. I heard that he had died from a heart attack. Mm-mm. I heard several other causes of death, but never the true one. Never AIDS, because you see that's a secret. We all keep that a secret. After all, if we tell that, we don't get bed partners. You know, that kind of shit. Well, I tell it, and I still do. But for 2 seconds, while I was driving down the... And then I laughed. Because I thought, wait a minute, that's not even an option anymore. I have 100 different options for any kind of feeling, thought, emotion, problem, whatever, that I'm going through. But that has not been one. It doesn't have to be one. Whereas before, it was the only one. And I think as a result of all that, I can honestly say now that I'm happy. I'm okay. I don't run around grinning all the time, but I don't hurt. Occasionally I do. Occasionally I'm sad. And I'm grateful for every one of those feelings. Because without some of the sadness and without some of the hurt, then I don't always enjoy the good parts. And there are a lot of good parts. I imagine most people have seen the movie Mame at one time or another, where she says to her friend the line, you know, life is a banquet and most poor fools are starving to death. Well, I kind of look at it this way. I may be skinny on the outside, but inside I'm just as fat as a house. You know, and that's all I can say about staying sober. Other than to say that if I can do it, anybody can do it. You know, because I'm just like everybody else. I was a drunk. I stopped drinking. I'm not. And that's really about all I have to say.
I want to thank the committee for asking me. I get a chance to travel a lot in this.
My name is Lila, and I'm an alcoholic. It always takes a few moments for my dad to show up, but I've gotten used to it. Silence doesn't bother me anymore, so I hope it doesn't bother you. Thanks, Jan. I want to thank Tim, Miller and Tim, for being so kind. When I talked to Tim on the phone, I really didn't want to put another comment about him. I'm sure you didn't think about it. No. He's been very, very kind in a quiet way this weekend while I've been my friend. Robin was gracious enough to call not too long ago, and there was my opportunity again in the midst of a lot of problems in my life to say, no, I just didn't have the strength. But for some reason, I didn't say that. And I thought, if all else fails, well, I'll just drive down on Sunday morning, and I don't actually bother with the whole weekend. Because you see, a lot has happened in a week, and that's life, and that's what sobriety is. It's about life. Sometimes it's like the ocean, you know, the waves are bigger than usual. Just recently, my love Jane said to me, in a book she was reading about these random waves, and they call them crazy, spontaneous waves. They just come from all directions. And she said that they're so big in the ocean that they can take the portals, or steel windows, right off an ocean liner. And I thought, oh my God. I'm afraid of water as it is, you know. And, but little did I know that it would parallel my life. And she also told me that the most dangerous job in the world, we talked about this morning, was commercial fishing. Can you imagine? I thought those guys were just out there getting a tan and getting all poor unfortunate fish and flopping them around in ice buckets and delivering them fresh in every restaurant in Santa Barbara and so on. Yeah. Everywhere. And, I came here on last Friday, and I didn't really have a good attitude, really, to tell you the truth. I came because I was desperate to get away. I needed to know. I know there's a few negative things, you know, when you're tired and you're not in balance. I don't know what happens to you, but what happens to me is I do not see through the eyes of God, but I see through the eyes of myself. And what I sometimes see is unprotected, and it's fearful. But a little thing began to happen, and I have come to believe that I need glasses now that I'm sick. I need a hand. So don't worry, Tim, I now know what time it is. I'll end in an hour. But the little miracles began to happen that restored me. You see, I believe in miracles. I believe in miracles for the last time. If I show up, if I just do the next indicated thing, then that's what's going to happen to me. that I will be healed, that I will be healed. And no matter how much is going on in my life, and believe me, I was surprised myself. No matter how much is going on, I will be healed. And the healing will begin in the most subtle and kind, and others will begin to open me up inside, and that great reality will again fill me up, and I will be able to breathe, my God, breathe, my God, breathe, my God. Because when I get fearful and too much happens, and I don't sleep, and the pain comes back in my heart, then I can assure you that I do not breathe, my God, and I forget, and I forget. And I don't care how long this is over. There are days when you may forget. But the great thing about the consistency and the habit of sobriety, the habit of sobriety, I mean, I hope your habit of sobriety is as dedicated as the habit of drinking, because you'll be safe then. And the habit of my sobriety is that if I can just stay going, if I can keep going, everything will be all right. And we pulled into the parking place, and Tim had arranged the room that we had requested, and it was really nice, because I had come to the Miramar to heal myself before, and I was in the same place, and that we live in an environment at home, you know, which is really like a resort, and we can hear the water and everything. That's not like at the Miramar. I mean, it pounds on that turf, and it just washes your soul, and you're, you know, I don't know what happens to you when you hear that water pound, but for me it's a cleansing. And I got out of the car, and we were taking the things into the room, and one of the little vehicles, you know, with the guy in it, a bunch of little baskets came by, and there's a young woman, and her name is Dana. And she had all these baskets, and I heard her say that, you know, that goes to that room, and just for Ryan, and I smiled to myself, and I was in one of those moods, you know, where you didn't want to talk to anybody. And I thought, Christ, I haven't even closed the car door, and it's upon me to be on, you know. I sort of stood against the car for a moment, and I looked at her. And I have a habit of sobriety. It's in me. It's like breathing. I couldn't help myself. My body took over, my hand extended itself, and I said, hello, my name is Lila. And she said, my name is Dana. And da-da-da-da-da, and what happened? And she was delightful. She was delightful. And she had that sparkle in her eyes, and I thought, oh, my God, and she gave me enough strength to get up the stairs and to be grateful to be here. And then in this basket, you know, I've done these conventions, and I must tell you that you get all kinds of interesting things. A lot of it's just stuff you've never used in your whole life. And, you know, the kind of stuff you find in apartments of people that are about 102 and different things. And I looked at this basket, and it was very interesting, and it had purple paper and little string and thing, and I thought, gee. And everything kind and how nice, because no matter how many people are made up in the world of AA, and there are those people here right in this room today born negative, I saw with some of them this weekend, and you know, but there's more people that are not, you know what I mean, there's more people that are not, and it's my choice as to where I look, and it is my will that will allow me to submit that decision, and as long as I use that will to make room for God, then I'll see the little seashells, and I'll see the cars, and I'll know that it was written with love. And then I looked again at a little cup, and in the cup there were little pencils and a little book, you know, something you could actually write with, and it was wonderful. And in fact, I did take that little book, and I wrote down some of the little things that this young girl had, I said, what she had in here. It was wonderful. In my basket, now I don't know about the other people's baskets, but I'm just assuming mine was special. Little tiny big book keeps falling. Do you think that means anything? I'm a spiritual speaker after all. I should have figured that. I have to wait the whole weekend. The only good thing is I didn't get one of those. Okay. I had a big yellow rubber raft in my basket. I mean, one of those things is like 8 feet long, and you can blow it off and float around in the water. It was absolutely delightful. It was delightful. And trail mix and some wonderful coffee, you know, ground coffee and a back scratcher. And these little miniature little shells, and actually a tiny little starfish and a little notepaper and a thousand other little things and a little sofa in the shape of the sun. And I thought, how gracious, how loving, how kind, how can put together a welcome that really heals me. And I forgot the most important thing of all, earplugs. Little tiny earplugs. It was marvelous, 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 you know. Not that you need them here, because of this young girl's tiny healing, every time that train came by, why, I rushed to the door and flung it open to see it. You know, she was able to restore me to be able to have a little bit of fun, to become a child again. It was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful. Going her own way, I don't know how long Dana is sober, but she exhibited more sobriety and strength and hope than I had that day. The next day, well, I wanted to play tennis. You know, I have the racket on my shoulder. I like wearing the tennis shorts. And I said, well, I may not play well, but I look really good. And, you know, and Jane played quite well. And in fact, she won one of the prizes or something. And I went out with the attempt to play tennis, but I really, I was unable to. And I didn't really feel dealing with the impatience of some of the other players. So I thought, no, you know, something, I'm not really, I don't have the strength for this tennis. But it was wonderful to spend 5 or so minutes talking with Mark and to find out that he's in his first year and here he is volunteering as the sports chairman of the event. And later on, Jane said, oh, he was great. He came out smoking a cigarette just to make sure everybody playing tennis is doing all right. And I wandered off to the Avalon luncheon, and again, I really didn't want to go, and I didn't feel up to it, but I had the habit of sobriety, and I needed to go, and I needed to be around people even if I didn't know any of them, really. And when I walked into the room, I ran into Renee, Tim's wife, and I said, may I sit at your table? And she said, of course, and she showed me 2 feet. And then I was blessed by what is referred to in the 12 and 12 as the mature AAs. And it's got nothing to do with age or time on sobriety, but it's a sense of serenity inside and a sense of peace. And there was a lady across the table, and her name was Teresa. And we talked about Ruth in the International Convention. We did a spoke there. And we shared some of our experiences at the International Convention. And it restored me. And it brought me back to the wonder and the magic and the blessing that I felt there. I had the opportunity to participate in that convention. And it was such an honor. It was one of the honors of my life. And outside of AA, I have had many successes. But that is one of the biggest of them all. And we talked about that. And she's sending me a tape on. Of Ruth, I believe you had her here last year, and perhaps you heard the part that she was gonged out in the International Convention. It was such a distressing thing. And Teresa healed me by her kindness and her gentleness. And I ran into her 2 more times, once this morning and again yesterday. And she will not know how the language of the heart is not spoken in words, but it comes through the eyes, comes through the heart. She never saw the woman before, has no idea about her, how long she saw her, anything about her. She will not know how much she healed me. She healed me because she's gentle inside, and I could see it in her eyes. It was so that that next evening when I listened outside to the gentleman speaking last night, no mistake, and she came and she sat beside me. I needed her. I needed her beside me more than I needed anyone else. She was the perfect person to sit beside me. She healed me. She spoke the language of the heart. We did not talk. She had no idea what is going on in my life. She looked in my eyes. She understood. I did not have to explain that to her. I am gracious to share my life with a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing. Who knows me, who loves me, who waits for me, who understands this is a difficult time, it is a change in my life, a very big change. A lot has happened. Death does that. Sickness does that. Closing up all things does that. I had the opportunity in the last week to close my mother's house after 36 years of her living there. And I walked into the bedroom where my brother died from heart disease at 21 years of age, and I had to say goodbye to that room because I would never be back. And it brought it all back to me. Brought it all back. I looked at the feebleness of my mother as she's moving into my building. And I had to put aside the horror of having your mother 2 inches from you. And I thought, oh my God, she's old and she's just can happen in your life from Sunday to Sunday. And that's just the beginning. We won't even talk about the unrecovered sober person, my sister, who is not untreated recovery. Sobriety without the habits of how to live. Stark, raving mad. At any given moment. Wrote a check for $430,000 and lived $2 from me. Did it in a weekend. Why? Visited at home. Our sober environment, our environment shared by God and all the angels and all the love and all the people. Laid on our couch and we healed her after her operation, the surgery and the hospital. And if you don't, then you have manufactured the misery that it says in the book you need not do. spiritual healing can come from love and graciousness and kindness and nurturing to yourself just as well as pain, to the old idea. And we put her on our couch and we took care of her. And she felt that peace and she felt that love and she felt that giving that is natural for us. And she thought she could buy it. My brother went in on Thursday for surgery and he thought it could have been life-threatening and it was no longer life-threatening outside. My other brother went in and his skin count. Perhaps he's out, perhaps he's not, I don't think so, I don't know. My nephew passed away from cancer after 6 months, he was 27 years of age. But my other brother had another baby boy and he was born. And that's life. And it all happened from Sunday to Sunday. So is time really? It's for us to measure. But I think in the new spiritual universe, it is not measured at all. And all in all, from Friday afternoon to Sunday morning, am I better? No. Am I better than I was? Absolutely. Have I had a little fun? You bet I have. Have I had some good laughs? Yes. Have I felt the kindness and the love of my friends? Phil and Linda, who drove up from Santa Monica this morning. Phil, who called my mother yesterday to find out if she was doing all right. How do you get these people in your life? April and S.K. drove over here this morning. Judy, who I've shared rooms of meetings with for 20-something years. Do we talk? Do we really know about each other's lives, Judy and I? Not at all. I'm not sure I know what she does, really. Prior to my choosing to take some time and retiring, closing that business, I'm not sure she knew what the hell I did. Has it ever affected us? Our love for one another, the wonder of seeing her this morning, can I tell you, it healed me. It healed me. So I don't know if you'll get anything at all this morning. Not really my business, the results. But I'll tell you, I have had more than I can measure. And here's the great part. I expect even more. You see, I'm an alcoholic. Just because I have stopped drinking doesn't mean that I don't want it all. I still want it all. I'm sober now. I can have it. I intend to feel as much as I possibly can. And I do not intend to wait for golden lives and a magnificent experience to befall me on my deathbed. I want it now. I want it today. I want it this minute. I want it inside. I want it now. And I can have it. And I only have to do two things. Two things. Stay sober. Stay sober means not drink. For me, it means doing nothing else. And make room for God. Well, that's all I have to do. It takes every ounce of energy that I have not to stay sober. To make room for God. If I make room for God and I'm busy about that, I'm sober. If I make room for God and my spiritual condition is sound, I'm not going to drink. When I joined the hole in the ground in Huntington Park, October 1st, 1969, the 60s, you remember your convention in the 60s, I thought, great, I haven't had a clue what they were like. I mean, I can't tell you that I was conscious in the 60s at all. Not at all. And when I, October 1969, when I did become sober, believe me, I was not conscious. I was sober, but I was not conscious. I was absolutely frozen in my body, terrified of this thing called sobriety, hating the sensation of it, the imagine, the emotion of it. Never mind God. Forget spiritual balance. How about breathing? I mean, I could not turn my head. I came in with alcoholic poisoning. My leg was already beginning to drag and I was 22 years of age. I could not lose my head. I was dying. Did it matter to me? Absolutely not. They could show me all the pictures of cirrhosis and livers and everything. Who cares? Because you see, I have come to understand that alcoholism is the most socially acceptable form of suicide we have in our country and in our world today. We just do it one day at a time. And that's what I was doing. I did not have the courage to kill myself, but I had the courage to do it slowly, gradually, and in the face of everyone that loved me. And did I care that I would kill you if I drove in my automobile? You are irrelevant to me. You are my problem. You got in the way. Didn't matter to me. Didn't matter to me. Because the life was out, practically. Practically out. I saw a sign on the wall of the hole in the ground, and it said, think, think, think. And I thought, I cannot stay in an organization that requires me to think. Because it is the result of this mind that I am as desperate as I am. This mind that had about 18 people talking to me while I was there in that meeting. All talking about, you dressed well, you got dressed for a meeting. You couldn't possibly be an alcoholic. Yes, you are an alcoholic. I mean, if you die from this disease, who cares if you die from this disease? I'd like to get out anyway. I just want to get out. But you got to stay because there's something here. Oh, no, there isn't. What are they saying? I used to look at these lips moving at the podium, you know, at a table there, and these big guys would sit up there and Duke and those guys, and their lips would move and they'd mumble on the bus. What the hell are they talking about? What the hell are they saying? I try to listen, you know, and I try to listen, and every now and then something would slip in there, like, listen for the similarities, and I would, something similar, maniac is up there talking. I mean, by the time I got through the judgment, you know, the guy had completely finished his talk, and I would have to go on in the hotel, try for this other one, listen to the similarities, and, I just couldn't get it, and couldn't get it. And then one day, I don't know, I was just listening, trying to listen, you know, trying to, like, cut the conversation and trying to listen. And suddenly I felt something. I felt like, wow. You know, here he was off death row and out of the latest prison, and looked like he came out of the latest prison of peace, and this guy was speaking out. I could swear to God, he was blowing me the ear, and, oh, Jesus, so, I was showering now because I was sober, and my clothes have been to the dry cleaner now, and, you know, my car no longer rattles and stuff like that, so my life is becoming very manageable quickly, and I thought, what the hell is this man have to say? I got to get out of here, and he just looked up, and I looked at him, and I don't know what happened. But you know what? I knew he was an alcoholic. There's no doubt about it. And I knew I was an alcoholic. And I thought, gee, maybe I can't get out of here as fast as I thought. Because you see, I was leaving in a couple of weeks. I was just going to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous until I got my strength back, until I could get back in the saddle. Because you see, I was on an alcoholism and the disease of potential, and I had it, you know, and it's killing me. I was dying and almost killing myself one day, and the next day I'm in AA thinking I got to get out of here, because as soon as I pull myself back together, I mean, I'll be better than before, and I'll know what to do, and I'll know what not to do, and I'm learning a lot of tricks here. And God, I never knew about this lunch you sing, this candy bar, and oh, wow, that'll really help the headache. Oh, boy, these big jelly donuts. Boy, they would work. Now, I could see how it was just 3 o'clock in the afternoon instead of a bottle of ice that was run by alcohol. I had an alcoholic life. I had a whole series of events that didn't have people, places, and things in them unless they related to alcohol. I didn't have friends that didn't drink. I didn't have an apartment that was conducive to living. I didn't have a compartment that was conducive to drinking. I was in an alcoholic apartment complex. I mean, you know, they're all over the place, and you can find them. And I don't know now. All these people seem to come in, you know, all right, some more, I don't know. But many years ago, I mean, we came in. There was very, very few places to go. You couldn't just pop yourself in and out of the hospital. You came in, you shook it out. You shook it out. And you lived in these alcoholic apartment buildings. They were dying, and it didn't matter. And one person went out, floating in the pool. Give a shit. The guy was dead. Didn't make any difference. You know, get to your booth, and then we'll handle it. And I remember saying to the guy upstairs, Cliff, I said, Jesus, I think the guy's dead. I mean, if somebody's done something, he's going to say, let's have a drink, and we'll figure out what to do. Now, that's the kind of alcoholic that I was. You know, the kind of alcoholic with that tremendous Irish pride, you know, where I always prided myself, I can get home. And then, you know, one day I lost the car, and I couldn't, and I thought, Jesus, this is not going to work at all. And then I would get the car, I would get as far as the garage, you know, and I'd park the car, and progression of the disease, the progression of the thinking, the progression of the disease. And then I would get to the, before the pool, and I would pass out, you know, by the steps. What happened to that guy? He never got to this. For the step parts. He, like, stepped into the pool, and none of us heard him because we were too drunk, and he was drunk, and hey, that happened. didn't matter. I was like, okay, because we're dead inside already. We were dead inside. The only time I felt any energy, excitement, and love and could fantasize and dream was when I had a bottle of scotch. Without that scotch, I was dead inside. And it reactivated me and made me come alive. And you know, then I would get to the pool. And then one night, one morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, since the sun came out, I would wake up on the doorstep. And I would go and reach my back to the doorstep. And then I would wake up half in, and you know, and I tell you, that's what it was like. That's what it was like. And then I stopped coming home. But that's okay. Because it was somebody else's fault. It was always somebody else's fault. And that was the progression of my disease. So when I got here, I was a kind of alcoholic. Not sure. I did smoke some marijuana and some stuff. I got completely paranoid. I cried like crazy. I was like, hell needs this. I went right back to drinking. I mean, Jesus, it was a horrible, paranoid-producing situation. So I have no idea what all that drug thing is about. Don't have any understanding. Don't really care one way or the other. If you ever had a glass of alcohol, then you did not know what the effect of that drink was going to be, then you and I have something to talk about. I can talk about that. I can address that unpredictability. I can address everything that comes with that package. That's all I know. That's all I know about. So here I am. If I was to join Alcoholics Anonymous, pouring this glass. I drank my scotch in a warm glass, in a normal glass. I've never had a glass of anything. With a cherry and toothpick and olive and crap like that in a glass, and taking up the space of good alcohol. Never appealed to me. I never put an ice cube in a glass. I never had a cold glass. And you know how slippery those cold glasses are. Never going to take a chance that my scotch would never even... Since this is my 20th year of sobriety, we could jump over a vehicle and never spill a drop of ice. So it remains. I know it's just not too long. Oh, about 20 years, 5, 6, 8 years ago, that I was no longer using that finger. And I thought, oh my, how about that? Drinking. I drink water like a normal person now. I don't drink it like I have to drink the whole glass. One sitting, and like a sip water. It took about 25 years of sobriety. Sip water out of a normal glass. But the interesting thing about my drinking, and I'm sure that you can all relate if you're sitting in this room today, and that is that when I poured that drink, before I poured the drink, when I began to think about having the drink, it began to work for me. You see, I understand the disease of this mind. Nobody goes out and suddenly a big bottle of scotch jumps out of the sky into their arm and flies down their throat. That does not happen. That's nonsense. What happens is you're going to sit here in this meeting and you're going to think your way right out the door. Way before you ever have a drink, you will become drunk. And then you will add alcohol to that mind. And you will be gone. And if you're lucky, you'll get back. And maybe you will and maybe you won't. You don't know that. It annoys me how frivolously we treat it now. When I was sober at the Holy Ground, they said to me, essentially, there's 4 things you have to do. They told me this in the first 24 hours. Now, I've got to tell you, in the first 24 hours, the fact that I could hear was amazing. But they were patient, and they waited, and they told me in simple statements, and they told me, and they waited for me to, like, finish. Because, you see, when I got here, I was shaking, and I was perspiring, and I couldn't hold a cup of coffee. Somebody was gracious enough to be kind enough to understand that the sick, suffering alcoholic, they never poured us a full cup of coffee. First of all, they never let us pour our own coffee because their coffee would go all over the floor. So they poured it for us, and they poured us a little tiny amount so that when we shook like that, I mean, you could hold on to it. I mean, I don't care how good you are when you're drinking, holding that glass. The minute you get sober, it's gone. So what happens to that bit fairy? You can just barely make for a little tiny drop of coffee. But I don't know what they make in a coffee these days now. But as a result of the beginning of my sobriety, I had to stop drinking coffee for a number of years, actually. Ripped my stomach right out of my body. They poured this little kind, it was so thick, you know, as my mother would say about her cup of tea, you could stand a spoon in it. And they would say, now drink this coffee. And it was never too hot. It was never too hot. And they try not to put milk in it when we first got sober because, you know, we were sensitive and we could get sick easily and they did not appreciate it throwing up on their shoes all the time. So they would pour this little thing of black coffee and then they would say, now eat these jelly donuts, have as many as you can possibly eat at one sitting. I go to meetings now with Ian Gilbert and callus sticks and all this crap and I think to myself, where is the drunk going to get the sugar needed to survive the first week of sobriety? You know, I don't know how that works now, but I don't particularly care. People are still coming to AA. If they come to my house and they're drunk, they're getting a jelly donut. So I had my jelly donut, and I was starting to shake a little less, and they told me to eat candy bars and all that kind of stuff that you have to do at the beginning. And all of the newcomers and myself in the first couple of years of our sobriety were running around going to doctors with severe hypoglycemia. But you know, it didn't kill us. It didn't kill us. And they also told us that we wouldn't die from lack of sleep. And suddenly, before I knew it, I was swept up and I was no longer leaving in 2 weeks. So if you're sitting out there and you think it's just a matter of time, be careful. I mean, I'm almost 28 here in a couple of weeks. And you know, that can happen to you, and I hope it does. I hope it does. They always say, you know, don't quit before your miracle, not our miracle. We've had it. It's your miracle. You know, claim your own seat. And after the first two meetings, I mean, I sat in the same chair, you know, all the time. And one time somebody sat in my chair, I almost killed them. And I was going out there and I said to Duke, who the hell is in my chair? He said, maybe it's a newcomer. Better be newer than they, or they're out of that chair. So, you know, you claim your place in Alcoholics Anonymous right away. And it's those habits of sobriety at the beginning that hold you in good stead for the rest of your sobriety. Because I have gone over all over the world and attended AA meetings, and I can tell you there's always a chair for me. Because I know how to claim my chair in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not afraid to walk where it is safe. Not afraid. The habits begin right away. The first thing they told me is make sure that you put the cap on your toothpaste. I put that cap on my toothpaste. What is this? An intellect such as mine that I have to be sitting here listening to these people telling me to put the cap on my toothpaste. And I couldn't figure it out. And then he said, you know, have you ever known a drunk that did put the cap on their toothpaste? And I went, oh, no, probably not. And that was the beginning. That was the beginning of a habit. A habit. A habit of sobriety. The simplest thing to go home. And you know, to this day, every single solitary day, I put the cap on the toothpaste. And I was in New York City. I was in, I don't know, somewhere in the mid-teens of my sobriety. And doing well. And I'll pound in. And I don't know what it's like in New York City in the morning. It's not like you can just go up and down the street, they're all one way. And I got into the back of the car and I sat there and, oh my God, it happened to me. I realized I had not put the cap on the toothpaste. Can you imagine? I was flipped out. I'm the chairman of a company and I'm flipped out in the back seat of the car. I said to this guy, and you know, I've got people with me in the car, you know, so count on me. And I said, turn the car around. I mean, I don't care how much you pay him. The guy turns around and says, hey, lady, are you crazy? You can't. I said, I don't care what the hell you have to do. Turn this car around. Well, you know, 20 minutes later, he turned it around and we went back and I jumped out of that car and I flew up to that hotel room and sure enough, I had let that cap off the toothpaste. Now, do you think I would have gotten drunk that day? Absolutely not. But I'll tell you this, I would have broken a habit of sobriety. I would have broken a habit that developed into me being one of the most consistent people you're going to meet. I am consistent. I am neat. I am orderly. My house is in order. I will not, under any circumstances and for any reason, ever not put the cap on my toothpaste. It is a habit that has held me in good stead. I will not throw it away now. I will not throw away the things that they told me at the beginning. I will not throw away the things that they told me, such as, always remember, live and let live, easy does it. First things first. But for the grace of God, there go I. Think, think, think. Think through that drink. If you just stop to think for 2 minutes, maybe you'll make a phone call that will save your life. 1,000 slogans right there in the book. Interestingly enough, I think they're after the chapter, the family afterwards, where your theme came from. Live and let live. Probably the greatest attraction to that I have seen evidenced in Alcoholics Anonymous, where I have grown up. Where I have seen the good and the bad, the evil and the kind, the compassionate and the hungry. And none of this has caused me to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. None of it. I've suffered incredible things and enjoyed incredible things. I have learned to become excited on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Learned to believe in miracles. All from the habit. Habit. The habit of traveling to another country. And before I go, you see, when I drank, I knew where my bottle of scotch was. You had them in the car, in the desk drawer. I had them everywhere. So now when I go somewhere, do you think I don't know where there's a meeting? I have a habit of drunkenness. I have an equal habit of sobriety. I know where there's meetings all over the place. I find out before I go. Maybe I'll go, maybe I won't go. That's up to me. But I know where to go. And my world came crashing in, and I had it more than I thought I could bear. I was able to talk. I don't know what it's like for you. Maybe you're healthier than I am, but it took me 27 years to cry like that. It's a series of little cries. The ones where you first believe if you cry, you will in fact stop. You will not cry forever. And you can just cry for the times that you need to cry. The habit of knowing that it's going to be all right that I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I learned here, that doesn't mean that people will not, and they don't have faith where they can only come. But I have never, ever had much respect for what I have been taught by the people that came before me. And, as with Dana, the people that come after me. When I went into the room, they said, there's four things, you know, Lila. First 24 hours of my sobriety. I mean, I've had actually had people say, you can't get too heavy with the God stuff, blah, 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 blah. You know, the little newcomers might scare them. I don't give a damn. You see, my job here, and believe me, over the years, I've not always done it this way. But my job at this podium is to share my experience. Mine. Not what you think it should be, what it is. For me, I'm not really interested in it. In fact, please don't debate anything with me after the meeting. I don't care. That's why you have sponsors. We do not apologize for our God. I don't apologize for my God, nor do I apologize for myself, who I am, my life. I was listening to Jack McNallan speak at the Thursday Friendship meeting just a couple of weeks ago. And he said, for the first 40 years over, and he said, for the first 20-something years of his sobriety, he said, who am I and where am I going? And he let you and the world determine that for him. And now he says, I know who I am, and I know where I'm going. And I can add to that, when I don't know that, I know where to go to find out. I can call my friends, I can call the people. They can talk to me in the language of the heart, and they will remind me, yes, Lila, this is who you are, and this is where you're going. And I will say, oh, yes, thank you for bringing me back to this great reality deep within. Because the great reality for me is, it has taken me a long time. And if I'm really lucky, it will take me the rest of my life. But I am falling in love with me. The more I love me, the more I'm inclined to want to love you. Some of you, I could not do that, right now. You're still not, I'm not interested. I will save your life, but I don't have to like you. I have been trained to save your life. It is a habit. I don't know how not to do it. But if you're going to hurt me, get out of my way. It's an interesting thing when you determine the difference between selfishness and giving. All through our book, it talks about receiving, 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 receiving. And yet I hear so many people at these podiums talk about giving and giving and giving and giving. And yet, do they talk about God? Do they talk about the steps? Do they talk about how to do that? No. And when I was 20-something years sober, I thought, what are you doing? You're telling these stories that everybody wants to hear. For Christ's sake, they drank their beer. Do they want to really hear that? Maybe they'd like to hear about how you found your God. Do I care what kind of God you have? Absolutely no interest. Why? My experience has been that I've gone through a ton of them since I've been sober. My God still is so vast and so big now must redefine itself. Does it matter to me that you have a Christian God or a non-Christian God? I don't care. What matters is that we pray. What matters is that we share the journey. What matters is that you respect my position and I respect yours. If I have one thing that's begun to bother me, because the prayer of AA is a serenity prayer for two, because we are now in 174 countries, and there's a whole world out there called the Middle East that needs us badly. And it says on the page that you got this, that we are non-denominational, and I am afraid of any limitation, be it even Christian. So when you say the Serenity Prayer, I mean the Lord's Prayer, I am beginning to say it is a wonderful and beautiful habit of Alcoholics Anonymous to do so. But I will say the Serenity Prayer, because nowhere in the literature have I read anything about the Lord's Prayer, but I respect the kindness and the gentleness and the compassion of the people that didn't know how to end their meeting when there was no way to have a meeting in no format. I thought, well, that's what we will do. But you see, we're a big organization now. We're all over the world. There are lots of God. There are lots of God. When I got up yesterday morning, it was early, and when we came back to the coffee, I saw two women place a blanket on the beach and put out all their food. 8 o'clock in the morning. And we were looking at them. I thought, well, not really sunny, but... And then we saw the ice bucket. And then they toasted each other with this toast. And I said, you know, I don't think that's orange juice. And sure enough, 8 o'clock in the morning. Now, a couple of hours later, they polished off that bottle, and I knew that it was alcohol. You can tell by the color. Well, you can tell we're experienced with this. Course, I think. And I thought, I wonder if they have any idea that 300 or 400 members of Alcoholics Anonymous that are watching them drink this bottle. It was really interesting. And when I got up this morning, I felt a little not so strong again, there are lots of things that are happening, and I did what I do, the habit I have. You see, when I have a physical problem and an emotional problem, I know that if I address my spiritual problem, they will be taken care of. Ruth has said to me, Ruth King has said to me 1,000 times, go to the same meeting for all those years. She said to me, there are no problems left. Every problem is a spiritual problem. Thus, every solution is a spiritual solution. Ah, simplicity, the why. So I did what I do, and I've been doing it all weekend. I opened up that little 12 and 12, and I opened up the big before. You have the physical strength. If you get there, you can stand up. It will be all right. And I thought, I have nothing to give. All the times I have spoken, I have thought, oh, I have nothing to give. But today I felt empty. I mean, I completely felt empty. I thought, what can I possibly share? And I heard it. Who you are, life. Your experience. You've been sober almost, whatever, number of years. You got up. You're capable of crying. You're capable of laughing. You're a charming Irish woman. You're a powerful, sober person. Share that. That's a lot from someone that was wrapped around a toilet seat 27 plus years ago. Unable to pray, hating God. Grabbing that sink and reaching up and coming out of a blackout saying, God, help me. And enraged that I would have prayed, enraged that I would have prayed to this God. But you see, it doesn't matter, because in a state of semi-unconsciousness, my prayers were answered. And within a really remarkable story, which I don't have time for, but in a remarkable way, I ended up at the hole in the ground in Huntington Park, where they told me the four things that I still have not told you, in case you're wondering what they were. And they told me within the first 24 hours. I suggest you stay. Because I have never needed anything else. How can you say such a thing to these wimbling, trembling little newcomers? I mean, all they can do is a day at a time. How you do it is a day at a time. However, you cannot drink again for the rest of your life. If you do not have that in your mind, and you do not understand that and believe that about yourself, then you have a reservation. And you cannot have any reservations whatsoever, or don't even bother to talk about or work this program. And that's what it means, wherever the steps are, that you are powerless over alcohol, for you will never have that power back. I don't care who dies, lives, or what devastation shall befall you. You can never drink again for the rest of your life if you're an alcoholic. Now, maybe you'll stop going to meetings and convince yourself you're not. But if you're here, that's the truth. That is my experience. They told me that, and my mind was saying, that's very nice, I'm out of here in 10 days. The number two thing is that I have to go to meetings. For the rest of my life. I thought, I cannot believe they are saying that to me. I am only in this meeting now because I'm afraid I'm going to drink. I may not even be an alcoholic. Oh, sure, all social drinkers come to AA. They go to meetings because they're afraid they might drink, you know, show up at 8 o'clock every night, do all the stuff they're supposed to do because they're afraid they might have a drink. For the rest of my life. I said, why do I have to do that? Don't you get it? I mean, can't you, like, graduate? He said, oh, no, he said. He said, you have a 24-hour memory. I understood that. He said, you'll forget. Of alcohol, the spirit of that disease, the spirit of the mind of the alcoholic, the language of the booze is so powerful that it will begin to talk to you. And unless you're in front of us, you will hear it. But you see, if you go to meetings for the rest of your life, in front of that voice will be the love and the care and the language of the heart of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you won't hear that calling. So I cannot drink again for the rest of my life because I have a terminal disease. And I have to go to meetings again for the rest of my life. And that's a lot of stuff. And then they said, now you have to clean house. I'd already cleaned my house with a toothbrush. And they explained inside. And they explained all the ramifications of that. And if you're new, don't worry about that now. Get yourself a sponsor and they will tell you what that means. And you will begin to sweep away the pain and the secrets and the isolation and the desperation and the loneliness and the sadness. And this won't go away forever. Why, it will come in layers. And it will delve a little, it will go deeper. And you can have from Sunday to Sunday. But by the time you have your Sunday to Sunday, you will have believed in them. There will be somebody there to carry you from Sunday to Sunday. And then they said you have to clean house for the rest of your life. Little did I know that I was welcome to that. That whenever I am troubled and whenever a lot happens, as they said, I must put all of that in front of me and look at where am I? What do I have to do? I said to Jane, oh, it's such a cathartic experience. I'm closing the door on my life. And I knew then that it was a huge spiritual experience. And her Celtic Irish humor, she said to me all life, it is not a spiritual experience. This is a nightmare. A nightmare. But you see, when you're sober and you know how to play in the sandbox of AA, you just hide in the corner. The nightmares pass, you know. Somebody will throw sand on you and get angry with them. That'll take a little edge off. Somebody will be nice and whatever. I love to clean house now. I love to look at my part of it because my job is to do the fourth thing. So the first thing is that I cannot drink for the rest of my life. The second is that I must attend meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for the rest of my life. The third is that I must clean house for the rest of my life. The steps, of course, tell me how to do that. And the fourth thing is that I must make room for God. I must find God and I must make room for God for the rest of my life. Little did I know that it would become the peace of my life. My search, my quest, my question about my God. Little did I know that I would spend all of my sobriety and God willing all of my remaining sober years, because you see, I do not intend to drink for the rest of my life. How can I make such a statement? Because I intend to go to meetings for the rest of my life. Because my spiritual condition is the first thing I address in the morning and the last thing I address at night. And between there, just in case I have a problem, why, I have the habits of sobriety. I have those phone numbers, and I know where to sit, and I have my seat. And I know those newcomers, and I can read that book, and I can be healed. I am protected. I am safer within the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous. I get more power from the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous and the God that protects me in order to be here than I ever did from the spirit of Scotch. It took me a long time before the Spirit of God and the Spirit of Scotch matched each other. But if you want to stay sober and have a peaceful, serene life and have a God and understand that greatest reality deep within, then you will someday have a God that's bigger than the booze you drank. And you will not be afraid again. And you will believe in miracles and you will expect them. Why shouldn't you? It was many years before I knew, having worked the steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the orders that they were in. 1 through 12. There was nothing wrong with all my efforts and my exercises before. All that did was make me ready to have the experience of practicing my program, mine, not yours. Alcoholics Anonymous gave me the tools. How I use them is my experience. Today, if something goes wrong with me, I will say that I am powerless over whatever it is. Sometimes it's big. Sometimes it's as small as envy. Sometimes it's little, sometimes it's big. Sometimes it's a shoelace, sometimes it's an elephant. Whatever it is, when I found out that I could be powerless over the smallest, insignificant thing, I'm powerless over everything. I spent maybe 18 years of my sobriety without being powerless. And I created all the things you need in life to make yourself safe. And I have those things. You don't have to be a missionary in China to be spiritual, believe me. And I wondered why I was dark. But you see, I needed to do that to find out. It wasn't enough. Thank God I stayed sober long enough to find out it wasn't enough. And that I had not been making room for God, I had been making room for Lila. Now, I used God along the way because the steps are a great band-aid for all of us, aren't they not? Now, I'm powerless over everything. I live in the question of life, nothing. I created answers for all those years. Good answers. It terrifies me now that I might have an answer. In fact, if I give you an answer, I can guarantee you my life is unmanageable at that precise moment that I'm giving it to you. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable throughout the literature, throughout the big book, and throughout the 12 and 12. It stopped talking about the disease of alcoholism right away. It talks about living, how to live. But if God could relieve you of the disease of alcoholism, could take away this obsession that drove you for all those years, then perhaps it could work on your other problems in your life. Perhaps it could. Perhaps it will. My experience is, it does. If you may, It says clearly, in the 6th step and the 12 and 12, you have to cooperate with God. Now, I think you're given a reprieve in the first few years. I think you can get to anything you bloody well want to. You can do anything you want as long as you're somebody, and they'll tell you what to do. And you do exactly what they tell you. You don't even have to question us, because they're giving you the love that they were given, and it doesn't really matter. And they'll tell you what to do, and it's a lot of people that like to tell you what to do, so you won't have a problem finding somebody. There's no reason for it. There's a ton of them. Believe me. They'll tell you what to do. And that's a great and gracious thing that there are people such as that, because I am not one of them, but I was. Believe me. They call them little Nazi people, and I was one of those, you know. Bam, bam, bam. All the stuff I would never have done, I have told people to do. But I kind of grew out of that now. But there's a lot of people there that will tell you what to do, and you have to do it, because they will keep you sober until you can find through the steps. They'll walk you through, God willing. If there's somebody you're working with and they haven't mentioned the steps, go find somebody else. But if there's somebody that you're working with and they haven't talked about God, please find somebody else. Doesn't matter, it'll all work out anyway, but you might save yourself a little bit of time. God. If you're not talking about God, you've missed the very basic bottom line of the entire program, which is, this is a spiritual program. I know a ton of people, by the way, that don't talk about God, and they have all their opinions about going to read the black stuff. I don't understand that crap about the black stuff. I read this and it means whatever I mean, need this to mean that day. That is my experience today, based on where I am today. How I look at the steps today, I can assure you it's different than last week, a year ago, and certainly in my first 2 years. So in the first 2 years, I think you should do whatever somebody tells you to do. They'll tell you the right thing. They cannot make a mistake. You are covered under the grace of the God of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that grace of God will protect you in your first 2 years. Don't worry about it. All you have to do is not drink, go to meetings, make some effort to do what they tell you to do, and know that you're looking for a God that's bigger than your scotch. That's it. You'll be all right. I understand the pen makes people play golf. I thought that was so intelligent of him. My God, I thought, that is great. You know, maybe I could get him out on a tennis court, and at least I'd get something out of the thing, too. You know, you learn from somebody every day. Every day. In all seriousness, I now say I admit that I am powerless over alcohol. I am powerless over any event in my life that I feel that I am not doing in conjunction with God. If I am alone in that adventure and have forgotten my God, I can assure you I will be rendered powerless. My life will be unmanageable. You know, you get sophisticated along your shoulders. You don't look like you have unmanageable lives. It just grabs your heart and makes you feel like you're having a heart attack. And nothing invisible, really. You know, your leg won't move, but that's okay. Sophisticated, subtle, unmanageability.